Tonight on the download, superstar Chicago architect Jeannie Gaines, Patriots Day director Peter Berg, comedian Lori Kilmartin, and live music in Studio 435 from the States. And now, here's your host, a man who is wearing his best dress to highlight his sternum, Justin Kaufman.
Now, that became a new hot thing, huh? Show your sternum at the Golden Globes? I'm in. I got a good sternum. I mean, medium sternum. I wouldn't go crazy. It is shiny. It's a shiny sternum. That's all that counts. I know, watching that broadcast last night, there were a couple times where I'm like, what am I looking at? Am I just looking at like a shiny spray tan chest? Like a chest bone? That's the new thing. All right, it's a new thing. You know what? I'm getting old. Maybe that's a millennial thing. Everybody's into sternums and chest bones. Good evening, everybody. It's Justin Kaufman here on the download, 720 WGN, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. I hope you're getting where you need to get tonight. The weather, the snow, a little bit of freezing rain in the area. I heard there's some traffic issues in the western suburbs. Hope that's okay. Hope you're not sitting in that in Naperville, in that area downtown right now. Looks like the snow has stopped just a little bit on the ground. But like I said, I hope you're getting where you need to get. Great show for you tonight. I'm very excited. It's always good to have a strong download to start the week. You know, when you start on Monday, it's like you really want to put your best foot forward. Tonight, I feel like we're doing that. First off, it is Touche. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy will be in studio to argue/yell about the Obama legacy. Of course, he's going to be here in Chicago tomorrow night, so we thought it'd be fitting for the two to get at each other. Dave, of course, Democrat, Chris, a Republican. On what we think of the Obama presidency, the 8 years in office, we'll judge him on economy, we'll judge him on foreign policy, we'll judge him on social agenda. We'll also, we have to judge him on politics, how that all played out. So it's kind of fun because I almost can tell you exactly what the argument's going to be because I've heard it all over the last year from Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. Because, you know, Obama was sort of a proxy for Democrats when Donald Trump and Republicans were running. So you sort of get an idea of, you know, you sort of already know what some of the talking points are going to be. But we'll have it out. 312-981-7200. That's coming up after the 7:30 news with Rob Martyr. Also tonight, coming up at 8 o'clock, superstar architect Chicago and Jeannie Gaines in studio. Talk about her amazing career as an architect and designer here in Chicago. She is the woman behind Aqua. She's a great building right here along the Chicago River. She's also the woman who's designing Vista, which will be the third largest building in Chicago skyline come 2020. Ground has already been broken on the construction. And we'll talk to her about what she thinks of Chicago architecture, being a part of the Chicago skyline, and just, you know, her philosophy, her basic philosophy and what it takes to be an architect designer in this world. So we'll talk about the beauty of architecture and, of course, her work here in Chicago. That's coming up at 8 o'clock. Also tonight, 9 o'clock, this is, like I said, you want to best foot forward. Peter Berg's going to join us, the director of Patriots Day. It's the new movie with Mark Wahlberg that really fictionalizes, I guess, is that the right way to say that, Pete? Fictionalizes? I guess it is. Fictionalizes a real life event based on the events of the Boston Marathon bombing. You've seen the commercial because it's got the classic last line, "Nobody messes with this city."
Saw that a bunch of times during the Golden Globes. I love saying that line.
No, it's like, that's what you chose to end the trailer. "Nobody messes with this city."
Ooh.
I don't want to, and we'll talk to Peter Berg about the idea of doing, you know, sort of movies based on real life events, because he did Deepwater Horizon, he did Lone Survivor, which was the story of the Afghanistan unit that was shot up by the Taliban. But it's always like, you know, I the cynic in me, just a very cynical thing to think, but I'm like, when you hear Mark Wahlberg at the end say, "Nobody messes with this city," or I'm like, really? Because they did. I'm just saying, right? I mean, it's a terrible way to think, but they did mess with your city, so But I'm sure I'm looking forward to seeing it. And Peter Berg will be our guest tonight. He was also the guy behind Friday Night Lights. He also developed it for television. So we'll talk with him. What an amazing career to have the movies that I mentioned under his belt and also do television. He's also a producer. He's an executive producer. You'll love this, Pete. He's an executive producer on Ballers with The Rock. Dun, 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 the football show on HBO. I mean, what an amazing, eclectic career for this guy. To do an oil rig movie, Boston Marathon bombing movie, Friday Night Lights, football in Texas, football in the NFL with The Rock. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot of other credits, too, so we'll talk with him. Also, Lori Kilmartin. I talked a little bit about her work earlier last week. She has the new CISO special, comedy special, comedian in L.A. She writes for Conan. 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad. This is a story that, I mean, the special is really born of a Twitter live Twitter sort of, I don't even know what you say, like live Twitter rant that she did when her father was dying of lung cancer. She just sort of used Twitter to tell the story of her father, but also to make jokes about the situation. It caught fire, went viral. Other comedians were tweeting it. And we sort of like saw like sort of cathartic comedy out of this work. And she put together a special that's now on CISO, 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad, which is really paying tribute to her father who she lost to lung cancer. So we'll talk with her about putting that special together and the jokes and everything that's involved. And then tonight, for Studio 435, back in action, The Safes, Chicago, I would say indie rock outfit, would you say? Kind of like a rock quartet, if not a quartet. The Safes are playing in Chicago coming up here, but they will be playing live in Studio 435 here in the Showcase Studio coming up at 10 o'clock. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, tonight, great show. Let's kick it off. But I was thinking about it. Politics, movies, comedy, architecture, and music. That's like a newspaper, right? It's like a magazine. We just gave you a this is like the 10 o'clock news up in here, except with interviews, right? No sound bites.
It's like the old Caramarine news.
Yeah, right. Like the old Channel 2 experiment, right? Yeah, right on.
I think took off.
I blame that on the lighting. There's some lighting issues there. It's like, wow, that's real spotty you guys got going on. All right, let's get to the carry out. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you know what? You don't have to. Here are today's top stories. President Obama will give his farewell address at McCormick Place tomorrow. People stood in line for free tickets over the weekend, mostly because they thought it was for the auto show. Hey, that's all good, President, but where's the new Camaro? Tickets sold out, and now they're being hawked online for thousands of dollars. See, who said that the economy was suffering under Obama? American spirit and ingenuity on display. Yay, USA! USA! Oh, they're fake? They're fake. No, okay. It's the last chance for people to listen to the oral skills of one of the best speech givers in history. If I were the president, I would end all my sentences with "so sad" and yell every third word and wear a really long tie, because that seems to be what people want in 2017. All that come together mic drop nonsense? Come on, that's so 2013. Trump's supposed to give his first press conference in 6 months in the next coming days. If I were him, I'd pause a lot and try to sound as much like a Baptist preacher. Right? Just flipping the script here. Change it up. It's expected that Trump will name his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as an advisor. This is raising some red flags in D.C. as there are anti-nepotism laws on the books. But Trump and his lawyers suggest that since it's not a cabinet position and it's just an advisory role, it's okay. When asked for comment, Ron Reagan was like, "What? I could have been a great advisor." And then Jeb Bush was like, "I could have been a great advisor." And then Hillary Clinton was like, "I was a great advisor. I broke all the rules. I did it anyway. Email me. Bye." The CTA got $1 billion from the federal government today to modernize the red and purple lines. So what's it mean? Will that money get rid of that Bernie smell that sometimes pops up and yet no one ever does anything about? Or how about using that same technology for automated toilet seats in public bathrooms for the train seats? Saran wrap. Or, I don't know, hire a couple conductors to walk through the cars randomly so people don't feel like it's the wild, wild west after hours? Wait, is there a suggestion box? I'll just put it in the suggestion box, right? My guess, though, wrought iron fencing, and then the rest just disappears. That's what's going to happen to that money. Today is the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone. The smartphone revolutionized Apple and the world. It's great. You can text, you can use apps, and oh, man, mine just ran out of battery. I swear it was just at 60%. In weather, officials say that 2016 was the second hottest year ever on record for the U.S. Also, climate disasters such as floods and tornadoes caused $46 billion in damages. Silver lining, though, doesn't seem like there's much we can do about it. So full steam ahead, Trump. What's the worst that could happen, really? Wait, Your Honor, I would like that last sentence stricken from the record. Thank you. Yeah. Eek. In sports, wow, the Bulls didn't even make it to the All-Star break without trade rumors swirling. First, it was Rajon Rondo, who after throwing a towel at a coach, is essentially thrown in the towel, benched. There's talk he might be heading to Cleveland to play alongside LeBron Braun. And trade rumors for our star shooting guard Jimmy Butler, who the Bulls may give up on building around. Yep, the same Jimmy Butler who was named Eastern Conference Player of the Week. Come on, and it's only January, Bulls. Come on! The joke is that the Bulls have won three straight and could go for the longest winning streak of the year tonight at the UC versus the Oklahoma City Thunder. Fun to watch the NFL playoffs this weekend. Fun to watch the Lions lay an egg. What's worse, being a 3-13 loser or getting to the first round of the playoffs and getting blown out? Oh, right, playoffs, of course. Packers won, though. They go to Dallas next week. Did you see Julius Peppers, Devin Hester, and Robbie Gould, though? Peppers looked like he was 25 again. Hester signed with the Seahawks to pretty much call fair catches. And Robbie Gould, well, he's kicking for the Giants. Good to see the Lovey Bears still contributing to the NFL playoffs. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's so depressing. Who needs those guys? What's Lamar Houston up to? I hope that he's rehabbing. Well, the Hawks are back to their winning ways, winning three in a row. The Red Wings come to the UC tomorrow night. That's always fun. And this weekend's the Cubs convention, which will be Chris Bryant's honeymoon. Bad planning. What's a Cubs convention like after the Cubs win a World Series? I don't know. I have no idea. What's it like? Ask great-great-grandpa? I don't know. Is it the year again? I don't know. And tonight's a national championship game between Alabama and Clemson. It's the first time there's ever been a rematch for a national title game. Bears fans play close attention, though. Something tells me the QB in orange, he could be in blue and orange come next September. And finally, the Golden Globes were last night, and Meryl Streep got a Lifetime Achievement Award. In the speech, she scolded Donald Trump, not by name, for his mocking of a disabled reporter during the campaign. Trump then went to Twitter to say she was an overrated actress. Finally, somebody calls it out. I mean, am I the only one who saw Mamma Mia? Thank you, Trump. That's the carryout for January 9, 2017. Hey, we got a bunch of leftover sushi from last night's Golden Globe party. You know, because of La La Land. Half off, if it holds. That's Donald Trump. Speaking for all of us in the Midwest, she's overrated, right? All right, coming up, we argue about Obama's legacy. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy in studio. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. You got one eye on that national championship game?
I do indeed.
Who you got in this one?
My head's telling me Alabama, but my heart is going with Clemson. Yeah.
I think I like Clemson only because I want the kid who's the quarterback to be the Bears quarterback.
Is that Deshaun Watson?
Yeah. He's just too good, you know?
He is good. Athletic, mobile. I mean, big body. It would be fun to see him in a Bears uniform, that's for sure.
I think we were having this conversation, with Doug Plank, and we talked about it with the Bears, but it feels like the system that the Bears have run with Jay Cutler, and they continue to do this sort of pocket passing, you know, the short pass kind of thing that they've done, it just doesn't work. So it'd be great to say, all right, you know what? It's the 2017 NFL. Let's go with a more Russell Wilson type offense. Let's get a guy who can move around back there. Let's pay him nothing for the first 5 years because he's a rookie, and bam, we're back in the playoffs.
Every team in the league has a quarterback that's mobile to a certain degree.
Right.
Some obviously
Cutler's
better
supposed
than
to be that, but
geez. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you do need a little help from your offensive line
right.
on occasion.
And you have to throw it to your guys, not the other guys, right?
That helps, yeah. Same color
Did
jerseys.
Did you watch any NFL playoffs this week?
I watched my Steelers completely dismantle Miami.
So good.
That was a lot of fun.
Miami, it's like watching. I love that they're like, Adam Gase, the former offensive coordinator for the Bears, blown out.
Yeah.
He was like, oh, I was like, well, he got his training in Chicago in the way that that's what you're supposed to do when you go to the playoffs as an underdog in Chicago.
The Steelers running back, Le'Veon Bell, the guy was an absolute beast.
It's unbelievable to watch him.
Yeah.
Because he plays football in a way I've never seen a running back play, where he hits the hole and he stops and he's patient and he just kind of waits for his blocks and then he goes. That's not how they teach it. I thought it was put your head down and run as fast as you can.
It's like if Franco Harris and John Riggins had a baby. It's Le'Veon Bell.
He's, when you watch Steeler football, I don't see even Ezekiel Elliott. He runs downhill but with Le'Veon Bell, he's so confident. The scheme is that way that he like stutter steps and just kind of waits.
But
and then goes.
As we all know, the road to the Super Bowl in the AFC unfortunately goes through Foxborough.
I don't know. With those guys healthy, the killer bees, as I heard them called today.
Mm-hmm.
Roethlisberger, Big Ben, Antonio Brown, and Le'Veon Bell. Killer bees.
Real quick, good reading if you get Sports Illustrated, or even if you don't, pick up the latest edition. There's a good workup on Roethlisberger in there.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right, you go right.
There we go. It's Touche. It's Monday night here on The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and in studio with me, the Touche players, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling. They join us every Monday night. Tonight, we
play.
Can we switch roles tonight? Can I play Roebling and he plays me? Because one day we got to do April 1st. If we have a show on April 1st, that would be awesome.
It would be good.
Awesome.
And yes, I do mean Playa with an A. So Playa. Okay, so President Obama comes to town tomorrow for his farewell speech, and we thought tonight would be a good night to sort of assess the president's legacy. 8 years as president of the United States. We'll talk with Dave and Chris about four different areas. First, we'll get a summary, if you will, to begin. But we're going to talk about the economy. We'll talk about social agenda. We'll talk about foreign policy, and we'll talk about politics. That's on the agenda tonight for Touche. Why don't we start with you, Dave Lundy? Give us your overall sort of statement about the Obama legacy.
You know, I think that Barack Obama's legacy is going to begin and has to begin with saving the world from economic collapse. Everybody forgets what we were going through in 2008, 2009, when we were losing 750,000, 800,000 jobs a month, when the after Lehman Brothers fell, and then you had other financial services firms also fall, and literally the economy, the entire financial fabric of our planet was on the brink of total collapse. And in fact, I was at a speech at David Axelrod was speaking at the City Club today, and I've heard him tell this story before, and he was telling the story of during the transition when all the economists, one economist after another, were coming in the room and giving all the bad news. And the news was catastrophic, like we are about to all die. And they were all looking to Barack Obama to see how would the president-elect respond. He's a young guy, doesn't have that much national experience, didn't exactly have a distinguished record in the U.S. Senate. And he was steady. And it was steady leadership. And it was like, look, we just have to figure out how to solve these problems and focus on solving the problems. And I think that you cannot talk about Barack Obama and as much as there are problems, there are issues, but you have to start with he saved the world.
Right.
And, you know, the economic expansion that we've had, it hasn't been the best post-war expansion because the damage, the carnage was so
vast. Well, we'll talk about economy in just a moment. Chris Roebling, why don't you get your sort of executive statement, if you will, on Obama legacy.
He's going to say, yeah, what Dave said is right.
A tissue of lies. Because the left knows that their stuff will never sell. And Barack was their, I think, dreamboat candidate for his vast personal likability and his sort of admirable story of coming from a unusual background and achieving all these heights of Columbia and Harvard and working out here in Chicago and making it to the U.S. Senate. But I think his policies were not even they were way too far left for the Republicans, but they were not nearly far left enough for the leftists. And I think that he ends up with he personifies this James Carville insight, which is you will never satisfy the left wing of the Democratic Party. But I think that we're going to get to politics, but it precipitated this reaction, this equal and opposite reaction, which is going to wipe out whatever tiny bit of substance he actually accomplished. And I think that along the way, unfortunately, instead of being a voice of reconciliation, instead of fulfilling the hope that everyone, including myself, genuinely had after the 2004 convention speech, instead of living up to his own speech, he became a polarizing and destabilizing figure. And I think he implicated sacred institutions.
All right, let's get to economy, chapter one. So the economy numbers, I mean, you're seeing a lot of it today, just the sort of breakdown of as 2016 came to a close. You've been seeing sort of end of year media that the economy has grown, that the unemployment rate is down, that Barack Obama has had tremendous success when it comes to the numbers. But you know, and that's what I want to discuss. Do the numbers, are they accurate? Do they actually portray the America we're living in?
So I think that, look, the numbers are the numbers. And I'm a data guy, and I go by the data, and the data is crystal clear. When Barack Obama came into office, all the numbers were bad and getting worse. The economy was in free fall. Unemployment was surging towards 10%. And the market, the stock market was at less than 8,000. It's now at almost 20,000. And we've had more than 75 consecutive months of private sector job growth. Now, is it 400,000 jobs a month? No, but it's been averaging about 180 to 200,000. And the most interesting thing, and this speaks to the carnage that had taken place before, and particularly in the housing sector, job wage growth didn't come back quickly. It really didn't. And I think that really Obama and the Democrats struggled against that fact because people weren't feeling it in their checkbook until this past year. And in the last year, wage growth surged at literally record levels. And that was both the salaried wages and then just this last unemployment report that came out saw the highest jump in hourly wage growth in a generation. This stuff matters. But I think that, you know, it's hard to divorce the numbers from the politics, because when Barack Obama came into office, the Republicans decided that despite the fact we were in economic turmoil, despite the fact we were in a massive crisis, they decided on January 20th at a Mexican restaurant with about 35 of them there, the story has been well documented repeatedly, that they were not going to allow Barack Obama to have any successes, period, full stop. They said, we cannot allow that or we will lose for a generation.
And we'll talk about that in politics. The economy, Chris, I mean, this is where Democrats will say that Barack Obama did well. We pulled us out of a tailspin in 2008, 2009. And the numbers do say that the unemployment rate has gone down, that the numbers are going up, the stock market's going up. So, I mean, a success for President Obama?
Well, I would say it's kind of a C-minus success. I mean, look, 150,000 to 200,000 jobs a month for 75 months is an accomplishment, and no one will ever take that away from him. And that's better than a lot of alternatives. Is it as good as it could have been? I don't think so. And here is why. It's not just the labor participation rate. And I know David's got his, you know, litany of reasons why labor participation isn't as significant as I like to think it is. But be that as it may, it's not just that. It is kind of the waiter and bartender recovery. I mean, because the wages have not been there. And I believe that this speaks to another issue, which is a determination, a hard and fast ideological determination by Valerie and the president that they were going to shape the economy in their in the shape of their preferences, okay, and their predilections, and if black unemployment in the inner city for youth was going to remain high, it was going to remain high. And if they were only going to get to 225,000 jobs per month, they were only going to get that far. And they made a decision, I think, after actually keeping faith with what Bush had begun before Obama took office, because, as David likes to forget, the Fed had already intervened massively in the economy, pumping up the economy. So the David likes to say everything started on the 20th of January 2009. Of course, that's not right, but we'll skip over that right now and just get back to the fact that they decided not to do more with the economy. They decided that their regulatory agenda and their government growth agenda and their taxing agenda were all more important than freeing the creative forces in the United States so that we could participate in this early 20th century global. I mean, there are things going on around the world.
So does that mean regulations? What do you mean by that? I mean, I think they sat behind a closed door and said they didn't want that mix of
very high regulation, in my opinion, stifling regulation. Regulation that, according to the various circuit courts around the country, has gone beyond the legal basis for their action. So they over-regulated in that technical legal sense. But economically, they strangled innovation and entrepreneurship and the kind of growth that we could have.
I hear the regulation argument, and I understand it because I have some friends who are in the financial sector who will point out, they'll say, it's paperwork, it's an extra thing, everything about it.
It's a fortune.
But weren't you in a situation in 2008, 2009 that we were in because there was not enough regulation?
No.
That we saw subprime lending?
No, really? We were not underregulated, and that's not what led to the Wall Street situation, Chris?
This is not the topic. If we want someday to talk about 2008 and what led to it, is a fascinating conversation. I don't think it's really the Obama legacy issue. But the fact is, I think that they decided that slow growth was enough growth, and they didn't take steps like John F. Kennedy to cut taxes, to grow the economy, to spur greater risk-taking.
Nobody decides that slow growth is the way to go.
Here's why I think they decided that because they went for 8 years and they never improved.
No, what you just said was just factually, historically wrong, inaccurate, false. You said that they decided that government growth is more important. Government grew less under Obama than the previous three presidents.
That's only because the Republicans got
Obama. No, it is not because the Republicans. Republicans.
I'm sorry.
No, that is just factually.
All right.
Once again, you're factually wrong.
You can take a look at the growth curve.
Touché.
The growth curve, David, changes when Obama was stuck with his own.
The growth curve changes when Obama is stuck having to live with a Republican Congress who refuses to do things like what Donald Trump has promised. No, this is not political. It's economic. What Donald Trump has promised to do, which is an infrastructure spending program. What the Democrats
spent $938 billion,
David.
And
half of it, in order to satisfy Republicans, was in tax cuts, not in the much more effective actual spending.
It was $938 billion, and of that,
and it was
this
not
Democrat administration could find only $38 billion in transit and infrastructure, and go back and check it, because that is the fact.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back.
Everything else was for the public employee unions. The unions ruled, and the rest of us took it in the shorts.
All right, let's take
GM is alive and Obama and
we'll
Bin Laden's
take a break.
Dead.
We'll come back. We'll do foreign policy. Stay with us. All right, Touche here on the Download 720 WGN. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio as we talk about the Obama legacy before his farewell speech tomorrow night. McCormick Place will be broadcast on NBC. It'll be broadcast everywhere. I don't think it'll be here because of the Blackhawks. But let's talk about, okay, so we had talked about four different areas to talk about. We're not going to have enough time. So social gay marriage.
Because Obama's accomplished too much.
He really is. gay marriage for social, political, gridlock in Congress. We good? All right, moving on. Foreign policy. Let's talk foreign policy. This has been one that, I mean, you look at the successes of Obama of ending a war in Iraq to actually the death of Osama bin Laden to what's happened in the Middle East to the sort of Arab Springs and the other things to some of the things that didn't go well, the controversial treaty with Iran, the Syria, there's other things.
Justin, Chris's head is a combined.
I know, Chris is really.
I got news for you. He didn't end the war in Iraq. He walked away from Iraq ill-advisedly, and by doing so, he left open this vast void for ISIS to fill. And then he and Kerry admits this personally in his own voice, used ISIS as a bargaining chip against Bashar Assad, thinking that ISIS coming from the East would cause Assad to negotiate with them.
And, but Chris, wasn't the goal?
I'm sorry.
He ran on the idea that he was going to get us out of Iraq.
Well, unfortunately, instead of getting us out in a way that preserved what we had gained, okay, we lost lives. We've spent a fortune. It was poorly operated by Bush. There's no question about that historically anymore. So it was. There were good things and there were horrible things. But it was handed over to him as a functioning. Very young, very fragile democracy, and he handed it off to the Shias. I think Barack Obama will go down. His legacy will be handing off to the Shia, to the mullahocracy in Iran, all of the northern Middle East, so that you now have from Karachi all the way to the Mediterranean, the influence of the mullahs in Iran, destabilizing Egypt, destabilizing Libya, destabilizing Yemen, destabilizing now Oman. People aren't talking about Oman. Oman is under the gun because of its position as a transshipment point between Yemen and Iran. And Iran is sending weapons through Oman to Yemen. His has been a record of disaster in foreign policy.
You know, look, Chris. Chris earlier in the show said that I like to think the world started on January 20th, 2009. He does too in certain respects, and one of them is foreign policy, because Chris conveniently forgets that the reason many of us, myself included, opposed the Iraq War was because it was going to create a power vacuum in the Middle East, which Iran was going to surge into. They surged into it long before Barack Obama was even running for the presidency. And that was a done deal. Al-Maliki was a Shia plant, was an Iran ally. The Iraqis are an ally of Iran. That was not done by Barack Obama, Chris. That was done by George W. Bush into the decision to invade Iraq ill-advisedly. You cannot ignore that. It also led to the rise of ISIS. You cannot ignore the role of who founded the core of ISIS.
Now, let me ask you this, because the one thing that has been very controversial.
What David said was fatuous nonsense.
And 100%
accurate. But go ahead. No, I mean, I'll get back to it.
Let me ask you. No. Let's get to the idea that, you know, when it comes to fighting terrorism.
Yes.
You know, we've seen Barack Obama, President Obama, employ a strategy of drone warfare.
Yes.
We've seen him sort of decide, you know, we're not going to invade countries like we did in George W. Bush tenure, other tenures. I'm going to have sort of war from above. Has that been successful? I mean,
no.
Yes, we haven't had troops on the ground, but there has been casualties and things.
Well, and you do have troops on the ground. I mean, look, I will say this, and Chris knows that I feel this way because he and I talked about this as this was all unfolding. I happen to believe that the president badly underestimated the threat of ISIS. I think the folks around him badly underestimated the threat of ISIS. I think when he got into it, he responded too timidly. I was with Hillary Clinton, who wanted to arm some of the moderates in Syria. I was frankly more hawkish than Barack Obama. We don't agree on how the Iraq War ended and how we wound up with the Iranians in control of the Middle East. But there's no question, and I think history will judge this, that the president did not succeed in how he responded. When he first responded to ISIS, rather than doing shock and awe, I did like six. The day he decided to attack, he dropped six loads. He did six sorties. No. These are bullies. They're the worst kind of bullies.
This represents the left's approach to, quote, national defense. They are unable to robustly defend the United States, its allies, or the interests that we have.
You cannot get away with nonsense.
Hold on just one second. And your earlier point was fatuous nonsense for the simple reason that if we knew, and we did know, you're absolutely right, we knew that al-Maliki was a tool of the mullahs when Bush handed off to
al-Maliki.
Barack. Okay, when Bush handed off to Obama.
Who put al-Maliki there, Chris?
And we knew that. And the point, that makes it more important than ever for Obama to have managed the situation. Instead, he walked away. But
so Obama cleaned up Bush's economic mess, but he didn't fully clean up Bush's a foreign policy mess?
No,
is that
I'm sorry. He made it worse. It's not that he didn't clean it up. He made it considerably worse. And people, hundreds of thousands of innocent Middle Easterners have paid with their lives because Obama, Kerry, and Clinton never really understood what they were doing.
And now you're reinventing the Syrian history.
No, that's not right. I've got to say this. He announced with great fanfare a historically important pivot to Asia for the 21st century. And then he essentially abandoned it. He announced with great fanfare a reset with Russia. And he sent Hillary over there for a photo op, but which, you know, Lavrov was laughing his head off at her. And basically lost all of that momentum. So I don't think. And then he went around and he was supporting Hugo Chavez and he was conceding to the Cuban dictators. He did everything conceivably possible to not destabilize the Chavez regime. And people are dying in Venezuela today.
No, I understand. But I guess overall, though, I mean, to get back to your point that the left, this third idea of how the left approaches foreign policy, there's not this sort of push to invade. There's not this push to arm and sort of do exactly what happened in Iraq. Is that it? I mean, that's kind of what the country was asking for after Iraq. It was asking for this idea of why are we doing that? So in a way, he played that out. Now, you're saying that we want to go back to the other.
No. I think that there is a vast panoply of national power and only some of it is force of arms. A vast amount, socially, economically, financially, okay, politically, through multilateral organizations. There's vast amounts of things that can be done to achieve a national or an alliance objective. And I believe that these guys came in, they know they did. I mean, Samantha Power sat down the hall and said, not do stupid things. And instead, I think that they're going to be looked at as having failed on that test.
All right. So we did foreign policy. We did economy. I feel like we still need to do social. We need to do political because they're two big parts of the Obama presidency.
We can stay after the hour.
Yeah, we got to move on. Jeannie Gang's going to be here. But you know what? Next time we get together, let's talk about those two topics because I think that you both would have insights and opportunities to argue.
And we have time.
We have time. That's right. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, appreciate you guys coming in.
Thank you, Justin.
Touché.
Touché. Touché.
This is... Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is one of Chicago's preeminent architects. Jeannie Gang was just named one of the 2016 Chicagoans of the Year by the Chicago Tribune. Add to that, she was also named Architect of the Year by the Architectural Review. And what a year it was for Jeannie and Studio Gang. Not only did she open up new offices in Chicago and New York City, but she also designed the Writers Theater in Glencoe, the dormitories at the University of Chicago, and started construction on Vista, the skyscraper that, when finished in 2020, will be the third largest building in town. And that's only three of what seems like a gazillion project games finished or is currently working on. Add to that Aqua and the Nature Boardwalk at the Lincoln Park Zoo, and Jeannie Gang is doing wonders to take Chicago's built environment into the next generation. It's my pleasure to welcome Jeannie Gang to the big table tonight. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, Justin.
I'm such a fan of your work, and I think Chicago is. I mean, just what you see, when you look out the window at Aqua and other places, so it's great to have you here to talk about architecture. I mean, you really have this year done a lot around community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of your work is about community and building spaces for social gatherings. What is it about that draws you as an architect?
Yeah, I think what I've realized over the years is that a building is a great impetus to start better social connections. And, as someone who's really committed to the environment and, the natural environment and the urban environment together, I think the only way that we can get people on the same page about the environment is to first have better relationships with each other. There's a lot of tension, as you know, in recent years, and I think architecture is a good way to help set up better connections between people.
As an architect, I mean, did it take sort of trial and error to figure that out, to figure out that you could be a moving force when it comes to easing tensions and improving upon
building
social situations?
Yeah, I think, in some of the first projects, when I first came to Chicago, a lot of our work, it took me to various different communities around the city. So we did a project for the Chinese American Service League initially, which was a community center. We did the SOS Children's Village Community Center. So it started to get to know the different communities around. and just realize that so much about making a strong city is about having good social connections, having people, you know their neighbors and have central space where people can come together. And that's what builds society.
When you first came to Chicago and you started to recognize this and went to different places, what did you know and what did you think of the architectural landscape of this town?
Well, I do remember when I first came back to Chicago, I had finished graduate school, had worked in the Netherlands and France, and then came back to Chicago. And I remember thinking, like, there was still a grittiness to it, and you would walk down the street and get pelted by dirt, and just, you know, there's still an industrial flavor, but it was slowly changing, and slowly there was more awareness about green space and the river and green buildings. And one of our first projects that we won a competition for was for the Ford Calumet Environmental Center, and that really helped me focus on just, you know, it's not only about downtown. There's also this vast landscape around the city, mm-hmm. which was transformed during the industrial era, but now is become really an oasis for a lot of different kinds of wildlife. But also, there's people that live there that are working in Chicago, and there's a chance to connect nature and city in those areas. So our design, which won the competition, was a design that treated the building like you would build a nest. In other words, using all the available materials from nearby the Calumet area, imagining reusing those materials, doing it with very little energy and being very green and sustainable. And it was a place where people could come together but also learn jobs for the green economy, the coming green economy. So it's kind of, when I came back here, it was just the beginning of real an environmental awareness, but also bringing me, like I said before, in touch with different communities and realizing and just getting to know Chicago really from the community aspect.
To think about you coming to Chicago and really wanting to work with in the areas that you studied, I mean, talking about environment and reuse and other, it's startling to me that Chicago has bought into the idea that now we have Aqua, or you're going to have Vista, which is the third tallest building. I mean, for you, as someone who came out of graduate school and came here to work in that kind of environmental architecture movement, is it surprising to you that I mean, I know you have a lot of confidence, I know, but it's surprising how much Chicago has just wants more and more and more of your work?
Yeah, happily surprised, I guess. but I think, you know, maybe because we tapped into something that wasn't being addressed, which was, you know, that the city and nature can coexist. And actually, what's really exciting about Chicago is that there's actually more biodiversity within the city because of the different landscapes that are starting to be promoted and built, like at Norley Island, at the Nature Boardwalk, at Lincoln Park Zoo, bringing together lots of biodiverse landscape, animals, and people. It makes it more interesting, and it also makes the city an important part of the ecological system. And so I think the reason why people have embraced it is just because it's more interesting. There's more variety. There's that this landscapes can do a lot for our environment, like absorb stormwater, and they make for great recreation spaces, nature walks, and really appreciating the environment. So what used to be impossible to do within the city is now really, the quality of life has just gone way up now that we have looked for ways to interweave these two things.
I think about, you know, the great architects of Chicago, and you think of all the people who've come, and we've seen the landmark fights over Goldberg buildings or Mies van der Rohe or all the different architects who've worked in this town. Mm. Do you feel like, I mean, it was a different time, but do you think that the people who designed the buildings, even the building we're in here, the Tribune Tower, thought about the same concepts of environmental design and being able to be one with nature, as you were just talking about?
This is a great question because, you know, if you think about Louis Sullivan, who was really trying to understand what is the nature of a tall building, because that was the first time they really started going vertical. And he really brought a lot of, in his work, the decorative aspects of the outside embodied plant life and floral designs. So he was trying to make the connection, but in a different way than what we are doing today. But also Wright was always interested in how building and landscape connected. I think Mies as well, in his own way, you know, this kind of the building as a transparency where you can connect inside to outside. So I think maybe every architect does it in a different way. But,
right.
you know, but Chicago itself is such it was built on the idea that it was in the middle of nature, nature's metropolis, you know, as the book goes. And so I think there's a special awareness of the just the environment all the way around the city. The city is only here because of all of the things around it, the water, the forests. And so maybe that's why maybe Chicago architects are more interested in that concept.
Well, lots to talk about. Jeannie Gang, my guest in the studio, one of 2016 Chicagoans of the Year, Chicago Tribune. Also, Architect of the Year, Architectural Review. That's amazing. Congratulations on
Thank
that.
You.
We'll continue our conversation here at the Big Table with Jeannie Gang in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Jeannie Gang, the preeminent architect here in Chicago. I mean, I don't know if they do it this way, the architect of note, right? You're a Chicago architect of note now. The 2016 Chicagoan of the Year, one of the 2016 Chicagoans of the Year at the Chicago Tribune. Also, Architect of the Year, Architectural Review. Amazing, amazing year for Jeannie Gang. Construction started on Vista, which is going to be one of the tallest buildings in Chicago. And we'll get to that conversation because I really do want to ask you about the tall building. But, you know, I want to get to Aqua and some of the buildings that you have designed downtown and in Chicago and its relationship to the world around it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the areas in which you put a lot of time and thought into research is water. You know, that building, when you think about Aqua, it's almost a reflection. It's designed as a reflection of its surroundings, the lake on one side, the river. Talk about your relationship with architecture and water.
Well, I think I've always been interested in environment and making sustainable architecture, but the city of Chicago is a city built on water, and so it's just very present in the city. As you know, a lot of the work lately has been on reviving the river as well
and bringing
that back into a kind of backyard for the neighborhoods of Chicago. But I think with, you know, more than trying to mimic water, what we were trying to do at Aqua is a lot of our work is starting with the material and starting with what's there. The material using concrete, it's fluid, you know, like water, it's fluid. And so to make a form that can be responding to that fluidity, the curvilinear forms of the floor slabs at Aqua, you can do that with a fluid material like concrete. And then the benefit is really that we could do make them different and more variety of shapes for the balcony. So everyone is different all the way up the building, slowly transforming. But what we discovered in this design process was really that once you start varying these slabs, it's possible for people to see each other. And I think that was the big missing thing for us. And I say us because, you know, we work very collaboratively at my office, and we all talked about how, you know, sometimes when you go in a tall building, you get in the elevator and it's very isolating, mm-hmm. and you go up and you never talk to people. And so just this idea of having the balcony slightly misregistered allows you to have sight lines to other people obliquely, you know, not looking right into their apartment, but, but you know, you share the facade of the building and you're sharing something and it's a community. And so we got really excited about this idea of creating, how can you create community within a tall building? Because that just wasn't there.
And I think about the other, you know, as you think about the world around you, and you do such a great job of the ecology, but also the ecosystem of mm-hmm. of the nature around mm-hmm. it. But what about the existing built environment? Mm-hmm. And I've noticed this a lot downtown, and Streeterville is a great example. My parents have a condo in a building that is just dwarfed by, in the last 10 years, you know, 17 other buildings that have just gone up around it.
Right.
I mean, how much are you as an architect and a designer thinking about how your building is going to fit in with the built environment that's already there?
Yeah. Well, I think back to my love of nature and ecology. Ecology is a subject of study that arose, and it's really interesting because ecologists don't study individual species on their own, like one thing at a time. They look at the relationship between species and also the relationship between those species and their environment. And I see that as a really great analog for doing architecture. So whenever I'm designing something, it's always about, like, who are we trying to connect to each other? And then how are we trying to connect people to their environment around them, which includes the other tall buildings that you mentioned. You know, you're not building it in a vacuum. And so there's a dialogue that goes on when your mind and when you're working on it, how the heights relate, but also how the building is situated, what are the potential views. We were really interested at Aqua in making very specific views to landmarks around it. And so that's, you know, what made us like kind of push in and out with the floor slabs to get views around a corner or something you wouldn't ordinarily see. But we always start with, like, you know, usually you get a site and it's maybe a rectangle on a piece of paper. But, you know, think outside the box literally and think outside the site boundaries to what connections you can make with the environment and with other people.
I mean, is that a shared experience for architects? I mean, is that I've never thought about them thinking about what's around. A lot of times when I think of it, I think of someone just like, get that building up as fast as you can, and we're going to make so much money off this. That's the only thing I ever think of. Yeah. I mean, is that a shared feeling for architects to think about not just their building, but what's around it?
I think so. I think I've kind of made it more into our philosophy, and it's always, you know, starting with what's there. What do we have on the site? What are the resources? What are the opportunities for every project? Like, you know, for the Writer's Theater, for example, the brief, the assignment was to design the most intimate theater possible. And we did that. We worked very closely with Michael Halberstam and Writer's Theater to figure out the best relationships between the audience and the stage. But there was also this other thing, which was, you know, the Writer's Theater was acting as a kind of almost like a de facto community space. Like,
right.
We realized that it had a bigger role to play. So by looking at what was needed in the community and what people said about Glencoe, that we kind of took the lobby space, which we had to use anyway and design anyway, and kind of made it work for multiple uses and to be able to accommodate dialogue and connections. And people are using it even in unexpected ways, like people are studying there after school and things like that. So it's really starting to work as a space that brings people together.
Architect Jeannie Gang in studio with me. One thing I always wonder, you know, because you look at a lot of your renderings and the designs, and it's just beautiful. How often as a designer do you run into, I guess, the challenge of what is on the paper and what actually gets built?
I mean there's ugly phases of every project that you know, you have an idea, you start to, you know, model it and draw it and things like that, and it's not always great when it starts out, but sometimes you nail it right away, but other times, you know, it's work, it's craft, it's iterating. And we have some projects where we built dozens of models for one run project till we got it. So, yeah, at least for me, for our process, sometimes it can be a longer road from A to B. It's probably the same with everyone. And it's just like one of those things where you know it when you got it.
Yeah.
You know it's there.
Are there some principles when you're doing the design and you're working with the materials and you're saying, you know, let's just go gray instead of blue? Are there any principles that you will not bend on? I mean, we talk about the ecology of the area. Mm-hmm. You talk about space and community gathering. Are there things that are Jeannie Gang, like deal breakers, if they need to be adjusted when it comes to the design of a building?
You know, that's a very good question. I'd say there probably are, but I haven't been asked to do those things yet. But usually when there's a constraint, like there's, you know, or there's a barrier or there's, something that a hurdle to get over, you know, try mixing it up, try different things, like come at it from a different angle. And, you know, ideally we want all of our buildings to be as sustainable as possible, and high performance buildings. You always come up against budget, but you know, sometimes the budget constraint can actually cause you to be more creative, and so I think there's lots of it's always about finding more opportunities.
Yeah.
That's the way you just look at it. But sure, there are challenges and barriers. I don't think there's anything so far in my career where I've said, like, I'm not crossing this red line yet.
But there's a skill in that. I mean, the skill and the ability to edit or to be able to look at a problem and creatively, you know, approach it in the same way, as opposed to throwing your hands up and saying, all right, well.
Right. And also I think because our work has started, you know, there's a body of work there. And so it's starting to attract more people that are like-minded or like what we're doing already. So, you know, it ends up being the people that are coming to us for design are already they already like the way we think or like the way that our work looks and I like what it does. And so that's feeling like in a good place, at least for us and in the point of the career that I have right now, because I like working with people that, you know, that are good collaborators.
And there are a lot of them right now in a lot of different cities. Architect Jeannie Gang is my guest tonight at the big table. She was just named one of the 2016 Chicagoans of the Year, Chicago Tribune. She's also Architect of the Year for Architectural Review, Studio Gang here in Chicago and New York City now. And I want to talk about that, about, you know, the idea of moving outside of Chicago. Because you have so many projects in so many different cities, either just finished up or going to be completed soon. So we'll talk more with Jeannie Gang here on the download on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
There's a movie out now called Hidden Figures about the behind-the-scenes women of color that helped America get to the moon. Our guest at 508 tells us about the behind-the-scenes women who helped discover planets and stars.
The opening bell, tomorrow morning at 5 on 720 WGN.
More with Jeannie Gang coming up here on 720 WGN. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, I'm excited about this, Lori Kilmartin will be here, a comedian. Her new special is on CISO. We've had so many great guests from CISO, which is NBC's sort of digital platform. All great comedians in L.A. seem to be finding footing at CISO. But Lori Kilmartin's story, 45 jokes, or her special, 45 jokes about my dead dad, is now on CISO. And we'll talk to her about that experience. It's one, like I said, at the beginning of the show, it's born from truth. Her father died of lung cancer during the chemotherapy, the hospice, and the actual death. She was live tweeting to her followers, and she was sort of using comedy as a cathartic experience for her. And it was a viral story that you know, was picked up by all the national outlets, and she was, you know, retweeted. And she's packaged those jokes into the idea of one special that'll be on CISO. So that's a coming up at 9 o'clock. Also, director Peter Berg will join us. He is the director of Patriots Day with Mark Wahlberg. They mess with the wrong city. It's coming up. Peter Berg, of course, did Friday Night Lights as well, Lone Survivor, Deepwater Horizon, director, actor, producer, writer, executive producer of Ballers on HBO, so he's got a ton of credits to his name. We'll talk with him about Patriots Day, which opens this weekend, and live music in Studio 435 with the Safes. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Did we figure out what happened with Derrick Rose, Rob? I was looking it up the last break, and it failed. He didn't show up tonight, huh?
Apparently, I guess he was benched in the fourth quarter of a recent game.
And so now he's just not showing up.
So I guess he's pouting. That's what I glean from what I've been seeing.
Hey. Three words, not our problem, right?
It's up to you, New
there
York.
You go. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Jeannie Gang, the great Chicago architect who was one of 2016 Chicagoans of the Year of Chicago Tribune and also Architect of the Year, which, you know, I guess that's a good thing to be if you're an architect. Architectural Review. At the beginning, we talked a lot about the projects you're working on. And one of the big projects is Vista. And that's the building which will be complete in a couple of years, which construction has started. It was a big, big story this fall about groundbreaking. It is going to be one of the tallest buildings in Chicago, if not the top three. That is a big distinction. How do you feel about that? I mean, Chicagoans have this relationship to their skyline, to skyscrapers.
Yeah, it's incredible because now that working in different cities, Chicagoans really love tall buildings, and that's unique. You know, it's almost our city. We don't have mountains and landscapes, but our skyline is almost like the skyline is the mountains of the city,
right,
and
it's
our natural feature almost. But it's great to be in a city where there's a kind of very forward looking about what tall buildings can be, and always pushing the envelope in terms of how well they perform and what structural achievements they have. So it's a good place to design tall buildings.
I always think of the Chicago skyline as very protective. You know, I remember a couple of years back, one building came up on the Chicago skyline that had like a neon top to it. You know, they put a blue line across the building. And I remember there being uproar, being, you can't just put a neon sign in this beautiful skyline that we've created here in Chicago. Do you feel, as a Chicagoan, do you feel the same way about protectionism when it comes to the skyline, to what was sort of, everyone knows as from the Hancock to the Sears, like, skyline?
Okay. Yeah. You mean like the outline of the skyline of the shape?
Yeah.
I think, you know, cities are about change. So there's always, you know, it's evolving and changing. And if you have a good set of principles about how to do tall buildings well, you know, there's lots of variety that's possible. So, yeah, I'm more open to change. I'd love to see more buildings that are pushing the limits, you know, on performance and sustainability, and also becoming more aware of how they meet the street and how they interact with pedestrians, and also how they interact with wildlife. In fact, you know, like birds collide with tall buildings. So it's really important to think about all of those factors. How does it connect into the landscape?
Well, I was amazed to stumble upon the Studio Gang website, you know, to looking at the research and the all the things that go into constructing a tall building, or at least the theories and the principles behind putting a building up. Because I'm thinking, you know, like everybody's just building as fast as they possibly can, and these mortars and everyone eating lunch on a you know, a 50 stories up as they build this. But there's a lot of technology, there's a lot of science, and there's a lot of design that goes into constructing a tall building.
The design stuff happens way before the construction starts. And with tall buildings, it's really important to the structural engineering is a major part. So working together with the structural engineer early on, and also making sure that the building, so it's almost like a street that's, instead of a horizontal street, you know, the vertical circulation becomes important. And that's really interesting once you get into more of the mixed use, which what we've been doing lately, where there's a hotel and maybe apartments and condominiums and retail, all those things have different needs for circulation. So that's another part that's interesting. And then, you know, design-wise, it's something you see from far away, which is not the same with smaller-scale buildings. You might not see it until you're upon it. And so the tall building has this dual role of being good when you come up close, but also having this role of being part of a bigger skyline.
Is it more difficult to keep to the principles of natural design and interaction with the built environment, everything we've been talking about, ecology, when you're talking about a structure so tall?
Well, everything with the tall buildings, like everything you do on a small scale gets multiplied by a lot. Like, for example, with Aqua, there was actually 5 miles of handrail on the building, if you spread it out. So you want to make, you know, so you have to think about very carefully about the details and how they can be made, the materials as well, like, you know, just glass, what the glass looks like from the outside, how it performs, where it comes from. And so, yeah, there's a lot to think. I mean, with tall buildings, it's, you know, just every decision you make is magnified. You know, modeling, we do a lot of modeling, digital modeling and physical modeling, especially mocking up parts of the building, putting it on top of our building and walking down a block and looking at it, or just using the city itself right outside the window as a test palette. So, you know, if you find a window that you like a color of glass and you match it to something in the city, you can see what it looks like from far away. So there's a lot, it is a little bit different way of working when you're working on a tall building. And we think about very much about the energy use of the buildings and trying to reduce that, again, like trying to make sure that the buildings are visible to birds because they're way up in the sky.
They're not expecting a building there.
There's also different winds higher up than low down. It's just a totally different animal, let's say.
Architect Jeannie Gang in studio with me. As an architect, I mean, do you dream of projects like this? I mean, you almost think of these as superstar kind of projects to work on Vista, to have one of the tallest buildings in Chicago. Is that something that you've aspired to? Or how, I mean, because a lot of the projects we've talked about have been projects like the Calumet one when you came into Chicago and you're talking about mixed-use centers, community centers. Mm-hmm. I mean, is the ultimate goal for an architect to build a skyscraper?
I don't think so. In fact, you know, like, besides Sullivan, which we talked about earlier, then the kind of the tall building went the way of more of the corporate firms and not so much design attention to them. So only in the last, I'd say in the last 10 years, where people, the design aspect is becoming important again. So when we were tapped for Aqua, you know, we were, it was the first time I ever was asked to do a tall building. And Jim Loewenberg, who was the developer at the time, asked me if I would be interested in working with him. I had no idea who's thinking about a tall building for me. And I went to visit him, showed my portfolio. I didn't know what he had in mind, but he said, well, what do you think about doing this tall building over here? It was called Building C at the time, not Aqua. And I said I would, was very interested, and he just said, well, let's get started. Show me what your ideas. And so we went back and came up with a couple of different ideas, showed it to him, and he immediately responded to the design, which later became Aqua, because he saw that we understood how it could be built, you know, using concrete, and we really thought about the inside and outside space. He knew that would be something that people would like. Yeah, so he hired us, and then what I really believe that, you know, not to cut out any type of architecture. I know a lot of architects try to specialize in one type, but I think it's important, again, I like to the whole city and thinking about how everything works together. Tall buildings are important because they create more condensed living environments, so that lends itself to walkable cities and lends itself to more sustainable cities because things aren't super spread out.
All right, so Philadelphia, St. Louis, New York, other American cities, and worldwide for you. As a Chicago architect, I mean, as someone who came out, who's done so much here in town, you know, and you've learned so much about the environment around. We talked this whole interview about understanding the town you work in. Is it hard for you to jump into a different market, to jump into St. Louis with a Chicago aesthetic? I mean, they're different places. I mean, as an architect, you have to do study on a different built environment.
Yeah, no, it's actually, it was great training ground to kind of be very specific and local to start out with and develop a methodology of working. And then now it's much easier to translate that and to kind of like go to a new place, get the things that you need to understand, but apply the lessons that were already learned and really in a hands-on way. I mean, our firm started, I started as one person with a little laptop and kind of grew very slowly over time, joined by my partner Mark and close colleagues, some former students, slowly grew the firm. And, you know, and really with very close connection to making buildings, like how they're constructed, how they're made, understanding the environment. And now when I go to new places, I know what to look for, looking for like what kind of materials are people in this new city good at doing, what's available, what's nearby, kind of like that bird's nest idea.
Yeah, right. Do you see, as you open up an office in New York City, do you see a time when Studio Gang and yourself aren't Chicago based, aren't Chicago architects?
No, I think it's really our headquarters and our core. As you said, we moved into a new space here in Chicago in Wicker Park, which is where we started, you know, the office. So it's really, it's a great location. One of the benefits is actually being in the middle of the country, because now we're working here and working in St. Louis, but also and in Little Rock as well.
Oh, right,
just started
right.
a project. But also it's easy to get to either coast, and so it's actually a really great city to be in for that reason.
Are you the kind of architect who considers these projects your family in the way that, you know, like you're saying, well, I'm going to be in St. Louis, I'm going to go see that building? Or, you know, like, are you the kind of person who goes and keeps a relationship with the projects that you've designed?
Definitely with the projects that we've designed, but also with projects that past architects have designed. So every time I'm in a different city, I'll be looking for, you know, what building was done by Meese in this town, or what did Burnham do in this town? And, you know, architects from Chicago, but also just internationally, that's part of the lifestyle of an architect, is you go to cities to see architecture. You basically live, your whole entire life is about architecture.
And my last question is really just about emotion. As we think about the built space and we think about the architecture that's in front of us, I mean, you can have your breath taken away by the buildings that are here on Michigan Avenue, or you know, the work that you've done in on Aqua and other places. The Lincoln Park Zoo comes to mind. Talk about the idea of an architect being able to draw that emotion out of somebody. I mean, is that the goal? I mean, I always say, I just remember having a conversation on a different radio station about whether or not they're just buildings or if there's art and there's emotion attached to the design that we're looking up at.
I think it's possible to just make buildings, and architecture is, you know, elevating the art of building to another level, and to, you know, what makes something architecture. It's when it inspires you or makes you feel elated or elevated. It's when you look around you, you know, you look off of your phone and you look up and there's a special space, and cities and great architecture can do that. And so, but when you're in the middle of design, there's many things you're thinking about. There's maybe the choreography about how people move through the space, how they interact with each other. You're thinking about how it looks as a form, and, you know, from outside in and from inside out. So I think some architects, you know, elevate it to architecture, but it is possible to build buildings that are just purely utilitarian and maybe not as inspiring.
So boring. Jeannie Gang, the architect in studio tonight. She was one of the Chicagoans of the Year by the Chicago Tribune, also Architect of the Year by the Architectural Review. Studio Gang has an office here, new office in Wicker Park, as well as in New York City. You can check out the work. Aqua, of course, the building right over here. I guess it's considered Streeterville. What is that?
Streeterville.
Also, the Nature Boardwalk at the Lincoln Park Zoo, which is extraordinary. Vista is coming up. The Writers Theater. I don't know why I'm listing all these projects
Hyde
at
Park.
The end of the Hyde Park. All sorts of stuff around Chicago and around the world now. Jeannie Gang, I can't thank you enough for being my guest at the big table. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Justin. It's been a pleasure.
Great to have Jeannie Gang here, 720 WGN. It was really amazing. And, you know, it is true. Like, how much are you inspired in your daily life by the design of buildings around you? I mean, I remember this, I was an art critic and a comedian together. And it was a conversation they were having. And the comedian's take was, what do I care? Like, it's pretty, and maybe it's ornate, and maybe, oh, wow, I sort of maybe marvel at the accomplishment, but it doesn't make me feel anything. Like, I don't have any emotional response to it. And the art critic was like, no, that's the idea is that we should be forcing the built environment around us to inspire us, to be more artistic, to be more edgy and daring, so it pulls something out of us. So it almost like, you know, sort of sparks a passion or gets us excited about walking down the street. I mean, what do you think, Pete? Do you think that buildings do that? Does architecture do that for you? I mean, do you feel like inspired by the buildings around you?
No.
Yeah.
Coming into this beautiful building,
right,
it's inspiring as opposed to going to a drab little office. So yeah, I guess in some ways it does.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
You're not working on TUI.
Right, yeah. Not going to a strip mall or anything. Nothing against TUI for our fine folks that listening on TUI.
No, I'm sorry. If you're offended by the TUI remark, Pratt, I'm sorry. Let me change the road for you. No, but I don't know. I wonder, because we are spoiled working here on Michigan Avenue, because where we're at on Michigan Avenue, and Jeannie Gang is a big part of that, has evolved in the last decade. Used to be this was just a place that didn't matter what the building looked like, just shove as many shops as you could shove into that building.
Mm-hmm.
Sell that thing. But now you're seeing the Riverwalk being reestablished and renovated, and the architectural experience of going down on the Riverwalk when you walk in the summertime and you're reflected against that wall.
Mm-hmm.
Aqua, which is the building, once you look up, you're like, wow, that's so great the way that it interacts with the Chicago River. There's something about it where you're like, wow, it almost looks as if the building itself is moving because of the way that the water and the waves of that building. And you heard Jeannie Gang talk about the way that she built it so, you know, it would interact with the things around it. Then you think about even here on Michigan Avenue, where you have almost significant generations of architecture, where you have the Wrigley Building, which mm-hmm. is right here, the Tribune Tower, which we're sitting in the base of right now. Across the way, it's kind of interesting because the 444 North Michigan Building has a sign in front in which it it almost in a 5 second, every 5 seconds, the color changes. So the whole building's facade changes colors from red to blue to purple. But why are they doing that? Are they just doing it for, so you, well, 444, I'll go to that Starbucks. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even here, the Apple store that's under construction right here, the idea is that to be somewhat of a design wonder, a, you know, glass box that you're like, wow, it's amazing to step into this. Yes, it's selling product, but it's amazing. So the question is, you know, how much of all of those things put together makes you actually stop for a second and almost have an emotional response to what's happening? I think it's an interesting debate. Mm-hmm. I've never been able to, one way or another, I loved when those two, it was Aaron Freeman and Andrew Patner, the late Andrew Patner, having a conversation where they were really challenging each other. And I've never been able to, because I, you know, agree with you, Pete, I don't know, you know, and I walk past buildings. But I also, at the same point, because we work in this beautiful building, mm-hmm. and, you know, you walked in, you have that feeling when you hit a certain part of town or even, you know, you're in certain areas of the region where you're like, oh, this is beautiful. You know, the built environment of a small town, you know. I was able to breathe. I went to Elmhurst this weekend. And you walk, you know, that sort of downtown, old downtown Elmhurst, where the York Theater's at. And you're kind of like, this is really classic, you know. This Buffalo Wild Wings is classic. You know? But the York Theater, I mean, there's something about it where you're like, this is really stoic and classical, and there's something about this architecture and these old sort of theaters and the way that evokes it. It gives me a feeling.
Great. Great.
I wonder if that's shared or if I'm just sort of a...
No, I think that's shared.
Too much of a hopeless romantic in the way that I'm like, oh, that building is great. It's so great.
Could be a little of that.
Yeah. I don't know. I wonder because it seems... I mean, we were just talking with Ro and Anna about the buildings at the Chicago River and the way that they're, you know, what's happening at Wolf Point Tower and what's happening with the buildings that are right at the corner where Wacker and Lake and that kind of, they built like five buildings there, and then Vista's going to be on the river as well. And you want, I mean, every one of them, the buildings are being designed in a way that is to sort of not only to be functional, but to have some sort of aesthetic value. Right? I mean, so they're not just office buildings. It's not the 80s anymore where they're like, build, put some glass on it. Let's go. Time is money. There's a feel of like the way it curves off the, I mean, there's just this attention to detail. So why do they do that? You know?
I mean, yeah, just looking across from Michigan Avenue from our studio here, you know, you see the beautiful Wrigley building as well. I mean, that inspires me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of times I stop in there every other day or, you know, I get a pack of gum or some salad dressing or something. I don't think about the building I'm going into.
That's true. It's not everywhere that you can go into your Walgreens and have architectural wonder around you, right? Yeah, the Walgreens, the architectural gem that is the Walgreens on Michigan Avenue. Yeah, it's just interesting. I mean, I would love to hear from you, 312-981-7200. You can text. I mean, we're going to move on with the show. We got some great guests coming up. Peter Berg, Lori Kilmartin, the band The Safes, the O'Malley Brothers. They're all here tonight. It's just something to think about, just about how, you know, art and culture, but more along the lines, in this case, the built environment, architecture, affects you. If it does, are you excited? Like, do you work downtown and you're like, I am jacked up about work because I work in a building that is, you know, design, like, has an amazing design.
I like, she mentioned this about how, like, Chicago's relationship with tall buildings, and I have a little bit of that in me, in that I was really mad that, you know, the Willis Tower, the former Sears Tower, you know, was no longer, I liked having mm-hmm. the world's tallest building here. I like when tall buildings are
like
here.
Like a pride to it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, there's a civic pride. And it is amazing to me, and I'm not alone. I mean, I mentioned it to Jeannie Gang in the interview, the concept that when they mess with the skyline, when you put a building up, or someone puts a building up that's not really that anything, and, mm-hmm. they're like, and then they may put like a spire or, you know, a neon light on it just to get attention. No, no. That doesn't, don't mess with our skyline like that. You know, if Jeannie Gang was like, it's going to be a black building, it's going to be about 40 stories tall, it's going to be a it's going to be a rectangle, and at the top I'm going to have a big red light. You'd be like, no, that doesn't cut it. So we expect more, you know. At least I do. Maybe I'm alone in that regard. No, I don't think I am. I think that the world around us is like, no, we will not stand for it. I mean, as much as you know, putting politics aside, the Trump Tower has a tremendous aesthetic value as a tall building in Chicago. Why? Because if you go down and up and down Wabash, and you're at any point on Wabash, like you'd be in the South Loop all the way down by Columbia College, right? And you look up Wabash, it is a straight shot up to that building, and it's shining like a beacon of light. Like, it's amazing to see how the sun reflects off the building. The same if you go the way, if you go northbound in any of the and if you're coming in from the suburbs, if you're on the Kennedy, you know, and you see that, you coming in, it used to be, you know, I remember as a kid coming in from Wonder Lake, Illinois, I would come to the city once, you know, every 6 months or something. You were just waiting with, you know, bated breath to be able to see the outline of the Sears Tower, you know, because that, and then you're like, here, there it is, yay!
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like that, you know, Trump Tower plays that role for a lot of Chicagoans now. So it does, that has aesthetic value as well.
Of course. Yeah. I like to know if a building has enough floors and lights so they could put Cubs win, right. You know, after they won the World Series. You know, I like buildings that are able to do that.
That was the last question I had for Jeannie Gang. Will there be an opportunity for you to write sports things on the side of your building? Will, have you thought about that, Ms. Gang? Is that something you're thinking about? Like, if you could say, go Cubs, will it be? Okay. Maybe some sort of breast cancer walk. Will there be a change of colors like for the 4th of July? Maybe Bastille Day? Mm-hmm. You got to know. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new movie Patriots Day hits theaters this week. It's the story of the Boston Marathon bombing and how the city of Boston responded to the terrorist attack. It stars Mark Wahlberg, John Goodman, J.K. Simmons, and several others, and it's directed by Peter Berg. Berg is no stranger to the big screen. He's directed films like Lone Survivor, Deepwater Horizon, Friday Night Lights, which he developed into one of the best television shows of all time. Peter Berg is not just a director. He's an actor, he's a writer, and producer. And he joins us on the line now. Mr. Berg, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for saying such nice things about Friday Night Lights. I really appreciate that.
There you go. Thank you. What drew you to this project? What drew you to Patriots Day?
I mean, I think it's unfortunately becoming a new reality of the world that we live in, that these acts of terror are no longer shocking, and they're happening with more and more frequency. And I wanted to do a film that really explored how we can react as a community to these acts of terror. And in the case of Boston, it was an extraordinary example of, you know, the very best of us and the way that city came together. Whether it was a 22-year-old Chinese American who was carjacked by the Czarnaev brothers and escaped and prevented another attack in Boston, or the cops of Boston, or just the hospital workers and the firefighters. It was a great look at a city coming together, very uplifting.
When you choose a project like this and a topic like this that was such a big news story in recent times, what are the challenges of telling that story on film? I mean, obviously, your people come out and say, that's not how it was, or, you know, there were more people here and this. I mean, what are some of the challenges you have to go through as a director to tell this story for the screen?
It's what you just, you know, hit upon it. It's, you know, going into a community where they're only 3 years out from at the time we were filming. The bombing had occurred 3 years ago, so the feelings were very raw and emotions were fresh and raw also, and we had to go and introduce ourselves. Unfortunately, Wahlberg is very respected in Boston, and we had to go and get people who were not necessarily, you know, clamoring for a film to be made, to support it, and then to feel as though we had understood what they went through and captured that very authentically and accurately was, you know, a challenge, and that required a lot of meetings and dinners and lunches and long talks with the members of that community.
You've had, in your career, at least in your directorial career, you've really taken on projects that were based on real life, things that happened, whether it be Deepwater Horizon, Lone Survivor. Talk about what it is about the stories that are both in truth and then told again in film that attract you to it.
Well, I think, you know, one of the challenges of just being an informed member of society today is the speed that the news cycle moves. You know, it's very hard to get past the headlines today because we're bombarded with so much news, and it moves so quickly. You know, something that a movie can do is take someone deeper into an experience. So, you know, obviously everyone knows that the Boston Marathon bombing occurred, but so many people have come up to me since screening the film and said, well, I had no idea about this and this and this, these aspects of it. You know, these are very complex, rich stories, events that if you spend a bit more time with, like a film can, you can really kind of dig in and capture more facets of the experience. And I think that it's important that we not just look at the headlines, that we really take a look and give ourselves the opportunity to form opinions and thoughts and let emotions develop when we're dealing with, you know, tragedies like the marathon bombing.
My guest tonight, Peter Berg, he's the director of Patriots Day, which hits theaters this week. I'm interested, you said this a little bit earlier about the idea of rallying around community, and this has really been a theme throughout your career in the movies that you do, whether I mentioned the movie Lone Survivor, that's and even Friday Night Lights to a point. I mean, there really is this kind of storytelling around a character that brings people together, that unites all the characters in the movie. Is that what you're going for? Is that a part of your filmmaking and how you approach the craft?
I think so. I mean, I've always played sports. I've always been a believer in team and in community and in the strength of team versus, you know, strictly individual performance. I always joke that I took, my college had a bunch of anthropology courses, and I used to take all these social anthro courses, and we would do things like sit in a bus stop for 3 weeks and observe human behavior at a bus stop and have to write it all down and study. And you think, well, a bus stop, there's not much that goes on there, but after you spend 3 weeks, you start realizing there's all kinds
there's plenty,
of
right?
unwritten rules of social, you know, behavior. And that always got me interested in kind of the group dynamic. And, you know, I like to, you know, believe, I'm an optimist, and I believe in the very best versions of ourselves. And I think that generally we aspire for that. And, you know, these are the kinds of stories that I'm drawn to. And I also like action, so there's usually something blowing up or somebody hitting somebody with something at some point in one of my movies, but that's just because I've always been a big fan of action.
Well, you've had such a prolific career, not just, you know, directing movies, like I mentioned, Friday Night Lights, directing the film and then developing it for television. You've been an executive producer on a lot of stuff, including Ballers and HBO. What do you like most? As a director, I mean, you're behind the camera. You've also been an actor. Is there one form that you like more than others when you're picking out a project?
Process, you know, because there's something really interesting about looking for a movie idea to make, where you kind of, you know, stick your nose in different places and meet people and kind of see what really hits you or touches your soul. And I like that part. And then the writing of it is, you know, the next part of the evolution, and that you kind of just get to sit and let your imagination run wild. And I love that. And then the actual making of the film is kind of like you're kind of running a small company for a year or so. And that's a whole different experience. And I think if I was doing just one, I'd probably get bored or maybe grow tired of it. But the fact that I get to keep, you know, I feel very fortunate that I get to keep kind of going through that cycle. And that cycle is very inspiring to me.
Is there one part of the process of filmmaking or presenting stories on television, film, other places that you don't like? Are you averse to the editing room? What is there one thing that you don't like?
Well, I'll give you a hint. We're doing it right now. I mean, it's what we do is hopefully a personal and a fairly legitimate and serious experience. And, you know, sometimes when you're trying to do press, and this goes right back to that news cycle thing, to kind of slam it into sound bites and try and sell it like that is, it's not, you know, I have so much respect for what you guys do, but it's sometimes I wish it was there was a different way of communicating, but it is what it is.
I can only imagine. Peter Berg is the director of Patriots Day, which is out in theaters. Thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Take care.
When asked, what do you not like about filmmaking? Peter Berg tells us, you. Yeah, I just have this thought in my head of like a bunch of publicists hanging around in the room, you know, like as he's doing the interview, watching the clock. And then they're like, How dare you? No, he was good. It's a funny answer, though, right? I think I walked right into that one. I don't consider what we do, interviews with filmmakers, to be part of the filmmaking process, but I guess he does because it's marketing, right?
Yeah. When you see, you know, you're watching the WGN Morning News and you see, like, Dean talking to, you know, the hot actor of the day or whatever, and it's always in a room at a hotel, you know, and it just looks like, you know, Dean's got a job to do. And
he does it well, too.
Yeah, yeah, he does. And yeah,
he doesn't put up with that stuff. That's what I love about him, because I've been in those situations where you have to do, like, the hotel interviews, mm-hmm. and they put the poster up behind him. And that is a lot of mumbo-jumbo. I mean, that really is where it's just like, 5 minutes for you, 5 minutes for mm-hmm. you. And it's just, and you could tell sort of the disdain. But when he does, when Dean does it, there seems to be a mutual respect. He seems to, I always wanted to have Dean on the show to do a big table, just to talk about that fine line of how do you keep the talent, the celebrities in line when you're doing those interviews, because you have a job to do. You got to get that stuff.
Yeah,
out. And he does such a good job. Like when we always talk about the Kelly Rowland when she was on talking about, I'm here to talk about contacts.
Yeah,
like, are your eyes dry? It's like, what? Like, it's like, we want to talk to you about your new music. I'm really here about 1-800 contacts.
And I think, yeah, that's awful, because I mean, yeah, we've been involved in this type of thing where, the person that it has the thing to plug also knows, you know, we can't just talk about the issue you're plugging. We have to ask you, you know, some sort of relevant question that relates to the news
or
whatever.
You start to get the feeling more often today, the cynicism of the actors and directors and filmmakers and people in Hollywood. You kind of saw it last night a little bit in the Golden Globes. I felt like there was more than there usually is of a sort of eye roll that we have to be here to do this dance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had Adam Conover on. He's the guy who does Adam Ruins Everything, the True TV show he was on. And he talked about that, I think, in the interview, but also on his show, about the Golden Globes in particular, and about the Hollywood foreign press, and the idea that that is, of all the award shows, the one that's most sort of dripping with rub each other, pat each other on the back kind of thing, where the American the Hollywood Foreign Press has these luncheons, and you show up and you take these pictures interviews, and it's almost like a pageant, mm-hmm. in the way that the person who does the best in those situations with those interviews and those pictures and is the best glad hander and the best person who's schmoozing is the one who wins for the award.
Right.
And so they force their talent, so Leonardo DiCaprio has to go, you know, take a couple extra pictures, if that makes sense. And so it just makes you at home when you're watching in Chicago go, yeah, is that really that's the best film? Or did they do the best dance?
Yeah.
You know.
And especially with the Globes, too, because it's like, a lot of times it's something that, like, last year was Mozart in the Jungle.
Yeah.
I'm like, Mozart in the Jungle, like, wins over Veep, you know? Right, I mean, you know, right. It's a fine show. It's a perfectly fine show. And then, like, last night, the Hugh Laurie show that's on AMC won a bunch of awards. I'm like, who knows what that, is?
That's the problem. And I've always had this, I always take the air out of the party. That's why I'm not invited to Oscar parties anymore. So I'm like, oh, one big infomercial. If it's not for the industry, which is Hollywood, to let everyone know what the great movies are that you should go to right now and spend your hard-earned money on, then it's the Golden Globes, which is, I'm not even sure what the parameters are for this winning or losing. Is it just the Hollywood foreign? What is the Hollywood foreign press? What is that? And so they just go, okay, we're going to vote on what's the best movie, good. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like...
Yeah. And I think it's a small group of people.
Yeah, exactly. And if you don't show up to that, if you're an actor and you don't show up and do the schmooze thing, then you don't win. And it's just, to me, it's like, so I'm watching half of that stuff last night going, okay, good. I'm glad that person won. But I felt like half the time I was like, I don't know if La La Land is that great or they just did the greatest presentation in the history of the Hollywood foreign press, you know, to be like, we are going to do a dance while we eat and you take pictures of us.
I love La La Land. I thought it was good. It was
amazing. Do you think it's a good movie to take my 9-year-old son to? I'm thinking about this because I was talking to another parent who said, yes, they did, and the son loved it. So I just want, I mean, it's, it seems like it's a musical.
Yeah,
it's,
what's it rated?
I think it's a PG-13.
Because I think we even said after, like, what was it? I don't even know if there was any cursing, really. Yeah. There, you know, I mean, maybe an adult situation.
I think for the cinematography and the idea of doing a musical, an original musical and that kind of thing, I think it's probably worth, you know, at least taking a look at. It's not, I mean, it's no Ghostbusters, but, you know.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that you should let him go see La La Land.
Did I tell you that I saw Ghostbusters? I rented Ghostbusters. Did we have this conversation?
The female Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
The new one?
I rented it on New Year's Eve, and it was an extended cut. And I saw it in the theater, and then I saw the extended cut, and they put all the jokes back in. Like all the stuff that there was probably another 15 minutes of stuff that I did not see before that's extra stuff with very, very funny actresses, right? Kate McKinnon, Kristen Wiig, Leslie Jones, and Sarah, what's her name? Melissa McCarthy. They're hilarious. And so their jokes were funny. They were off kilter. They made the movie much more off kilter, meaning they were like funny little word plays and they would go a little too long on their improv. But it was funny because it's Kristen Wiig, you know? And they cut all that stuff out for the blockbuster, you know, July 5th opening. They cut all of it out. I guarantee, go watch it again, and you'll be like, that's so interesting that they let these comedians, they open it up, and the cut that's on demand is much more free. And it's this kind of thing where the actors are doing, I mean, it's still cheesy in the way it ends and, you know, chasing ghosts, but they let the actors, there's scenes in there that were not in the original. And it makes the movie much better.
It's interesting. I wonder if it all has to do with running time, because we often go through this, like, how long is it? Is it 3 hours? You know, I don't want to sit through a 3 hour. You know, it's like that kind of factors into whether we're going to go see a movie in the theater or not. So I don't know. Like, do they need these like comedies to try to stick to like close to 90 minutes?
I'm not a movie guy. You know, it's not something I know, but I do know that budget was huge, and the budget was huge because I read something about that it was because of all this, the effects, special effects at the end with the ghosts and things that were kind of unnecessary in the way that you're like, wow, that's a big ghost. Oh, wow, that's a shiny ghost. You know what I mean? Like it was like almost like that's what they put their money into. So they probably couldn't cut that stuff because it costs so much money. So what it cuts is the
content,
improvising
the
of
jokes.
Melissa McCarthy and Leslie Jones. And you're like, wait, that's what I wanted to see. And it feels much more like a movie of that is from that crew with the extra jokes in it. Now you're like, oh, I see what they're going for. They're going for, not unlike the original Ghostbusters, this sort of like chemistry. They have this thing, and they removed it for the blockbustery.
That's disappointing.
Yes.
Kristen Wiig and Steve Carell did a really funny bit on the Golden Globes with the announcing the animated movie, and like their first animated movie they saw, and Stephen Carell's like father left him that day. It was funny.
That's
they're funny
it,
people.
It was, that's always what's makes those experience that award show worth it. Not necessarily the fashion or the actual awards, but when the comedians get up there and joke around, give me a Will Ferrell any day, right?
Yeah.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Lori Kilmartin. She's got a new CISO special, which is called 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad, which is really a collection of the jokes she told on Twitter when her dad was dying of lung cancer. We're going to talk with her about that. We also have live music from the Sapes. You can hear us setting up in Studio 435 as we speak. Speaking of the Golden Globes, Jimmy Fallon did a bit last night where he like did a word association kind of thing. I was like, Friday night, I had a show. I did a show at the Hideout for Mark Baser's interview show, and I did essentially the same bit. And Jimmy Fallon stole it on Sunday.
Yeah, he did.
Low hanging fruit. I stole it from somebody else, but he stole it from me. No, but I thought it was funny. I saw that. I'm like, oh, I'm glad I went to stage because I was gonna do. I should do it tonight, but I was gonna do it. And I'm like, I'm glad I did it on stage before Jimmy Fallon did it. It's where he did like an intro. He almost like tied all these words together to introduce him. I forgot who he introduced, but it was something that was at the Hideout. We'll talk about it after the break. But I did this bit where it was almost like, this is what I say before every show. Whenever we do the download, this is what I say. And I said it to the room, and it was really not what we usually say, but it was like, you know, 4 minutes of word association.
Yeah, I was very, I was at that, you know, I went to go see it, and I was very impressed at that that bit, that word play that you were able to remember. Like, how did you remember that?
That's a good question. It's sort of like once you get going,
it just the next word just comes in. Yeah. It's like, yeah,
it's fun. It's an easy, it's easy. I'll do it after the news.
All right.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll do it, and then we'll talk to Lori. How about that? Does that sound good? Thank you, Rob. Coming up, Lori Kilmartin, comedian, Los Angeles, writer for Conan, TBS. You see Conan's going to a weekly? It's probably a good idea, although I kind of went away from Conan O'Brien for a while just because, we do the show and things like that. But I recently in the winter break rediscovered him. That's a good show. It's a good crew. Always been a good crew.
I'm very happy about the one day a week. Yeah. There's just too much to watch.
It's too much.
And like Samantha Bee does one show a week, and yeah, I watch it. John Oliver does one show a week. I always find time to
it's
watch it.
It's definitely easier to consume. Not to say that we would be once a week. We should be daily. But at the same time, it's definitely because there's so many shows that are doing the exact same thing on television right now. Well, that also means there might be opportunity for more produced stuff from Conan, which is great. Mm-hmm. That's sort of where I'm enjoying where he's going with the trips to different countries, things like that. So he's always been good at that. On Friday night, I did a little show at the Hideout to celebrate the season 2 premiere of the interview show on WTTW with Mark Baser. It's a long-standing show. Mark said at the beginning of the show, he said, for 9 years, I've been on his show for 9 years. I was on his first show at the Hideout 9 years ago. I'm like, 9 years ago? Wow. I've done so many half-baked bits on that show. It always starts with, what if we did this? Oh, that sounds great. And then you flash forward to the screen or to the stage, and then you're like, oh, why did we decide to do this? I did two bits at the show for it was really a viewing party. And the first bit, I was working on a character where I play an aging improv teacher. Did it with Rachel Mason. Rachel Mason, who does Brittany and Brittany, Second City. She's great. But the concept, and I really like, I got to put on a wig. I got a nice wig. It's kind of like a lace front wig. Gives me sort of a Bradley Cooper American Hustle look. That's what I was going for. It's really strong, really strong look. But it was funny because we got up there, and the idea was we're going to teach. Mark needed to take improv classes, so he hired two of the most legendary old improv teachers in town. So I was kind of making fun of my teachers I had when I did improv back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Like I just had all the guys who were on stage in the late 70s who were like, oh, what do we do? Oh, don't talk. Next two up. Do your improv thing. I got such a hangover. That was essentially how I was taught improv, right? And, we did the bit. It bombed. It was no good. It was one of those where, you get up there and you're like, all right, how many times can you say the same thing over and over? And that's sort of the bits I do on the interview show is like I'd come up with a character and then just say the same things over and over until people are like, get off the stage.
As somebody who's in the audience, I wouldn't necessarily say it bombed.
Yeah, it was funny because after, of course, this happens every time. Like the next day I was thinking about it. I'm like, oh, I should have done this line or should have done it. Like it essentially is what I would say about my contributions to the interview show is that they are rough draft. Are always sort of the first round, and you go, you know what, that would be great if I did it again. And then maybe one more time, and then by the fifth time you do it, you're like, what a great bit that it seems like was. But the other bit I did was a word association thing. It was really fun because I was kind of working it out over winter break because I was like, well, I'll do this at Baser's show. And I got my son involved, and he helped me. And it was really funny because there was this moment where he really got into it. Like we're in the car and he was coming up with it. Because essentially what you do is you attach each word to the next thing. And he came up with a really funny one in the Whole Foods. And I was with him and I turned to him and he explained it to me. And he's 9 years old. And I was like, that's better than half of the comedians I work with. And I turned to the Whole Foods cashier who was ringing us up at the time. And I'm like, that's amazing, right? And of course, she had no idea what we were talking about and refused to cooperate, meaning she was just like, I don't know what you're talking about, and I don't care. Like it was that vibe. It was that attitude. But it was funny that I
hope that doesn't discourage your son from getting into the comedy game.
He wasn't paying attention. But, but the best part about it was my son got to come to the hideout on Friday night. So he got to watch. And it was really funny because he was really, really proud after the bit was done, you know, because we did it and dropped the mic. And it was that actually worked. And he was so funny because at the end he came up and he big hug and he's like, "Oh, I can't believe you did it." And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, "Well, I kind of thought you would screw it up." And I'm like, "What do you mean I'd screw it up? We've been working on it." And he's like, "I don't know. I just, you know, just thought you would screw it up." So I was like, "Well, at least I haven't, like, at least he hasn't figured out expectations yet." Like, there's one thing of not screwing it up, but then there's another of, like, actually doing it well. But the bit was very simple. We'll do it right now. The bit was, you know, I say at the top of the show, so Mark interviews, and he said, you know, tell me about your show. I'm like, "Well, it's the Download. We always say it's a show about Chicago starring those who know it well." And then he interrupts, and I go, "Well, you know, there's a little bit more. It's a very small thing we say at the top of the show. It's a very small thing where we say, we like to cover everything from the White House to the House on the Rock to Rock Island to Island Lake to Lake in the Hills to Hillcrest to Crestwood to Woodstock to the Stock Exchange to Exchange and Federal to the Federal Savings and Loan to Lone Wolf to the Wolf Lodge up at the Wisconsin Dells to Dell Computers to Computer Outlets to Outlet Malls to Mall of America to America the Beautiful, Please Rise, For Amber Waves of Grain, Grain Alcohol, Alcoholics Anonymous, Anonymous Quotes, My Favorite Quote, Do What Your Heart Tells You, Princess Diana, Diana Ross, Ross from Friends, Friends and Family, Family Affair, Sly and the Family Stone, The Stone Miner from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Reindeer Games, Hunger Games, Jennifer Lawrence, Lawrence and Uptown, Lawrence and Broadway, Uptown, Uptown Funk, Bruno Mars, Mars Space, Space Mountain, Disneyland, Land of Oz, Green Emeralds from Minecraft, Squares, not circles, but those circles, those balls you had for Christmas, those chocolate balls would just be like fireworks shooting out of your mouth. It'd be so good. Oh, God. Oh, God. God. Church, steeple, open it up. There's the people. People Magazine survey says number one answer on the board, Steve Harvey, Harvey Dent, Two-Face, FaceTime with my grandma, my birthday. It's my birthday. Get a Slurpee. My birthday at 7-Eleven, 7-11 on 720 WGN.
Yeah.
There you go. See? That's a bit that essentially we did at the hideout.
That got a good response.
But that's what I'm saying. If you watched, it did get a good response. But if you watch the Golden Globes, Jimmy Fallon did the exact same bit.
He did.
It's essentially taking the last, like, I was hoping to do it. It kind of got out into fun word association there. But I really enjoyed the idea if I could name all, if I could just make it all Chicago towns. If I can make it all suburbs, like at the beginning, kind of starts that way. But it kind of got funny. And the part that that my son came up with, which I really enjoyed, was the part where I kind of get too excited. And I go, oh, God. Oh, God. And then I pick it up again. God, church. And, like, he came up with that. And I was like, that's brilliant. That's why I turned to the Whole Foods. I'm like, that's brilliant. Right? Hello? How much?
No, crickets.
Card? Can I put the chip? It's got a chip? So anyway, that's the bit, which was good. So, I, but yeah, it was really fun to watch last night with my son and go, hey, Jimmy Fallon took our bit.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me and I'm like, well.
Did he get it? Did he understand?
Yeah, he understood. He's like, "What? How did that happen?" I'm like, because it's not that important of a bit. Like, it's very low-hanging fruit. A lot of people do this kind of stuff. That's how I did it. So anyway, it was a good show. And the interview show can be seen on Channel 11, I think on Friday nights. I was on last night as well.
You were also on the Chicago Newsroom with...
I was with Ken Davis Robin Amer and Daryl Holliday from City News Bureau.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did that. That was on CAN TV.
I think you could find that online. I thought you were very engaging, and
it was,
you
about
were funny,
the media
too, as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, buddy. Yeah, really. That was fun because we were arguing about media. And Robin and I, who worked together at a different place, Robin and I started arguing together like we did in meetings back in the day. Kind of took over Ken's show by just arguing back and forth. It was interesting. I feel like, and it was kind of the same thing, you know, like a lot of comedy and media is really sort of biased towards the left. It's just the way it is. They're artistic. You kind of saw it with Meryl Streep last night. And I don't know, like there's something about the way that it kind of plays out that as a rabble rouser that I am, that it becomes real easy to kind of point that out. It becomes easy to kind of go against, because she was doing the same thing about, you know, Breitbart is this neo-Nazi, you know, how dare, like, they don't do the facts. And I'm like, hold, slow your roll, you know, because anyone on who reads Breitbart may actually say the same things about the publications that you work for or that, you know, you read or subscribe to. I mean, that's the problem right now, is that we're polarized and nobody believes in the other side's facts.
Yeah.
You know, you could say the word fact doesn't mean anything anymore. And because, you know, you're going to sit here almost ivory tower and be like, facts are important. We do facts. Others don't. I'm like, nah, it's not. I think it's more, I think it's much more complex than that, as we're seeing. And I feel the same way, like at the Hideout, because I was making the joke with, I think Mark was making fun of GN for whatever, like at the top of it. I said the same thing where I kind of said, you know, go ahead with your bubble. Like everybody in here is laughing at the bubble, but you know what? You saw on election night, it went a different way. And, you know, it was sort of half-mixed crowd reaction to that. But I do. There's something in there that's like, it's a tough time to be a comedian who doesn't go with that flow. You know, if you call out, or a pundit, if you call out that there might be another point of view in this country, it's, you know, it sort of is met with this sort of hostility. Or if not hostility, then it's sort of like, oh, no, there's not. As you saw last night with Meryl Streep. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this past week, LA-based stand-up comedian Lori Kilmartin released a new special on CISO. The title, 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad.
It is tough to lose a parent. It's even tougher if you were hoping to lose the other parent first. My mom is a pistol, and that's what you want to put in your mouth when she talks to you. Okay. Loaded pistol. I'm not the only one who feels that way. My dad's last words to me were, "Ha ha, she's your problem now." And then he ascended to heaven like a conquistador.
The special is part stand-up, part documentary, telling the story of Lori's father's bout with lung cancer, chemotherapy, hospice, and ultimately his passing. The origin of this special comes from Lori's live tweeting of the experience, which attracted national press and millions of new followers. The tweets, the documentary, the stand-up special, they're poignant, emotional, and, of course, hilarious. Quick example from Lori's tweets. "Guys, I'm just trying to grieve in advance so I can relax and have fun at the funeral." Kilmartin's special is just the latest in a great comedy career, which has spanned a few decades and includes stints as a finalist on Last Comic Standing. Currently, she's a writer for Conan. Lori Kilmartin, welcome to The Download. Thanks for being here.
Oh, man, I'm so excited. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about this, because this special comes from the live tweeting of the actual experience of your father's sickness. So talk about when you decided to actually document this in a humorous way.
It was when he was dying. Before he was dying, I was tweeting about it and joking about it on stage, kind of thinking, you sort of that magical thinking of, well, if I say something, you know, if I project that he's going to die, he's not going to die, because if you say the worst thing that could happen, there's no way it's going to come true. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he did die. So I guess I just had a bunch of material, my comedy has come from my personal life, my entire career. So it was sort of natural to get up on stage and talk about it.
How was it in, I mean, you've obviously had this a life with your family, but your family's reaction to just the experience, not only of just live tweeting, but the overwhelming response to it. That's really what it was, all from not only the comedy community, but all sorts of people from all over the world coming out of the woodwork to follow your story and your dad's story.
Yeah, it was overwhelming. And the cool thing was that it was really comforting to my dad, because people, you know, 99% of them would say, you know, "We're thinking of you, thoughts and prayers for your family." And that meant a lot to my dad. We would read people's responses to him and his lung cancer. And, you know, in his waning days, I think he really turned to his religion, his Catholic religion, and it made him feel better.
You know, the idea of taking this experience from social media, from Twitter, and transferring it to the stage, I love at the beginning of the special that you have to essentially explain who you are. First, you do a joke about your dad, and then to the audience in the room, you have to explain you're a comedian and this is what you're going to do, because it is material that people are not used to hearing in a comedy club.
Yeah, I was kind of forced into that, because when I would just drop it into regular jokes, you know, regular stand-up jokes in a regular nightclub, people were a little taken aback, and a lot of people didn't like it. Even if half the crowd doesn't like it, there's a noticeable dip in the laughter. So I decided to just call it, you know, exactly what it was, which is 45 minutes of jokes about my dad dying. And then hopefully people going in would know and be into it.
Right. That's the name of the show. I mean, they're going in to see it, so they're going to understand. It is interesting just thinking about the dynamic of crowds and the way that audiences come to experience comedy. To have a comedian on stage talking about such dire, you know, situations and circumstances, it is something you really do have to almost handle it with kid gloves. And you do so well in the way that it's your personal story, but at the same time, you do make the audience comfortable.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, it's a tricky one to navigate. And there's a lot of jokes I had to lose because they were just too dark or too real, not funny enough. You know, I hate to, you know, you're a comic, you hate to think, well, it wasn't funny enough. Maybe that's it too. But yeah, I mean, I kind of just kept going back and forth between a really dark one that I could feel people pulling away from, some people, not everybody, and then doing something a little softer and easier to take and then go back to a dark one. You know, it was just a constant dance, really, with the audience.
Well, I mean, for a stand-up comedian, a lot of it has to do with testing the material in front of an audience. You know, when you were testing the material or trying things out, I mean, how did you find that balance of what's dark and too dark?
Just silence. That's really, it's a really easy way to test, is there's a noise after a joke or there's no noise. And when there's no noise repeatedly, you can't blame the crowd. You go, well, you know, four in a row have told me they're not into that one, so I'll drop it.
We're talking with comedian Lori Kilmartin. Her new special is on CISO right now, 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad. It's a story that she told on Twitter during the experience of her father dying from lung cancer. It's therapeutic in a way. I mean, you talk about this in a lot of interviews about, you know, this routine, this special, this project, all the jokes that have been made. I mean, there's a way that your dad lives with you even after his passing through the jokes you tell about the experience.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I think about him all the time now. You know, I still write jokes about him. It's a little different now since I'm 3 years past. But that, you know, I guess that's to me how I memorialize my dad, is making fun of him or making fun of the situation and making fun of the ridiculousness of hospice and somebody dying in the living room where you spent 30 years of your life watching football games. You know, it's so surreal and strange that you've got to do something.
You talk about in the documentary portion of this special, you talk a little bit about the comfort that comes from social media. You know, we've known social media, especially in this election cycle, to be polarizing, to be a negative space. You hear more and more people talk about, you know, I'm not putting Facebook on my phone anymore, or I'm removing Twitter and things of that nature. In this experience, when this happened to you, there was a comfort in the way that the people sort of rallied around what you were doing, the story you were telling.
Yeah. I mean, it was to me too. I didn't feel alone. And my sister and I and my mom were the only ones there at the end. And we were all equally freaked out for different reasons. You know, mom losing her husband, and my sister and I were in the same way, losing our dad. And so it was kind of nice. I mean, she's on Facebook too. She wasn't writing jokes necessarily, but it's just nice to have people go, me too, same here. It's very comforting to know you're not alone in this really strange, surreal situation where the person you love the most is leaving. You can't stop it.
Since the special came out last week, I would imagine you get more of that response. Is it interesting to relive the experience from when you did it in real time on Twitter to having it be a special on CISO?
Yeah, it's weird because I taped it 2 years ago and then I sort of just put it away in my head. And so, yeah, it is sort of kind of like that time again where people are just discovering it and saying, this happened to me too. My mom died. You know, this is reminding me of my situation. It just, you know, proves how comedy can connect people that are stuck in this feelings that you can't articulate and you don't understand. And if someone can get a joke out there that kind of nails it, it's a nice release.
Stand-up comedian Lori Kilmartin's new special is called 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad. It's on CISO. She's a longtime comedian. She was a finalist on Last Comic Standing. She's currently a writer for Conan. Lori, thanks for taking some time out and talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Lori Kilmartin. There we go. Good little interview there about her CISO special, which is pretty funny. Those tweets are hilarious. I mean, it's weird. I mean, it's a weird experience. Don't you think it's weird? Like laughing at someone else's pain that where they're making jokes out of it. But it's funny stuff. It's just funny. All right, coming up, Studio 435, the Chicago band The Safes, the O'Malley Brothers. We're going to talk to them about the not only their music, but they're going to play live in studio here on Michigan Avenue tonight. So we'll do that in the 10 o'clock hour. We do that every Monday night. We got some great bands that are coming up here in January and February. Pete Zimmerman's doing work. 312-981-7200. Oh, I will say this. I haven't paid attention much to the national championship game because we've been doing the show, of course. But wow, it's looking good. I just turned on the TV and I saw that Clemson scored a touchdown. So what does that make it? 17-14?
It makes it 17-14.
Yeah.
17-14.
How exciting.
It was a good game, man.
Wasn't last year it was like a 45-40 blowout?
Well, I mean, it was a close game, yeah, right. But they scored a lot more points.
Yeah.
Yeah. You make a good point there. I'd like to go back and see what the over-under was for this game.
Yeah, right. I would assume that they're not going to hit it because they would think that there's going to be like, you know, based on last year's numbers.
Man, these teams are so good though. Wow.
I mean, it really is. It's great to watch two, you know, teams so evenly matched. I mean, it was funny. I think I was listening to Nick Saban who was talking about the idea that the two best teams in college football got to the national championship the way it was designed to do. You know, like them, and that was the idea, right? The reason we have this playoff now is because too many times there was weird kind of who's the number one and who's the number two, right. And you didn't necessarily have the best teams, and we got the number one and number two, and they're playing like they're the number one and number two in the country.
There will always be issues with your right. 3 through 10 teams, if you will.
Right.
But you're right. This is the way it should be, and we've got a great game on our hands.
And they both won their games, you know.
Yeah.
Handily, really. And it wasn't even – so they're ready to go. I mean, it's amazing. They're coming into the – when they start getting close to fourth quarter here.
According to ESPN.com, they're about halfway through the third.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll pay attention to that. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. Coming up, The Safes – in studio, we're going to do a little sound check during your newscast, Rob, so don't get too worried when you hear the walls reverberating.
Justin, I'm a broadcast professional. I can, you know, you can throw pretty much anything at me. I'll be able to plow right through it.
Thanks, Rob. It's the download here on 720 WGN, and it's time for Studio 435, our Monday night showcase featuring live music from the best Chicago has to offer right here in the All-State Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Tonight, it's a family affair with the Chicago rock band, The Safes. Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley are in studio with us tonight. They got a new album out called Record Heat, which can be found on iTunes and other streaming sites. The Safes are going to be on stage at Township on Saturday, January 14th, for an all-ages show with The Difference, The Hustle, and the XOKs. And they are ready to play live right now. Here is a track, I Would Love To.
I don't wanna die alone. I don't wanna
The Safes live in studio 435. Coming up to the microphones here, guys. Come running around. The O'Malley Brothers, as they are known, the band The Safes, just put out their album Record Heat, which can be found on iTunes and other streaming sites. Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley in studio tonight. Guys, thanks for playing. That was great.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So, I mean, so many. I feel like all of my questions are about how three brothers work together. Like very, that's. I feel like
very well.
Yeah, it's good.
Surprisingly.
So, talk about this. I mean, you guys. I kind of called you guys a rock band, but talk about your influences. I mean, as brothers, I mean, are you listening? Are you growing up listening to the same stuff?
Same exact records.
All the same records. Yeah. So then we have. Anytime we reference something, it isn't like. You know, the bass player is a metalhead and doesn't know anything about, you know, when we talk about a Buddy Holly song or something.
Right, right,
right.
You
know, there's nothing that we bring up that is like, you know, one member's like, duh.
Right.
That doesn't happen.
I mean, for you guys, I mean, is music come, are you, is it a family affair when it comes to the music that you play? I mean,
definitely.
When you were kids?
Our dad is a musician and he collects instruments and records, and our mom is a huge music fan, and they had, you know, they always had music playing in the house when we were growing up, and our dad played. He had a band.
When did you guys start to pick up instruments?
14.
When we were, yeah, teenagers.
12,
you guys were
13.
Younger. You were like, Michael was like 11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Michael could play right away. I taught a bunch of people in the neighborhood, and like, I remember when I showed Michael how to play the first thing, like G major scale, and he was like, do, 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 do. I'm like, oh, okay. I thought someone taught it to him. And then I'm like, okay, play this boogie bass line. I was like, do, 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 do. I gave him the bass. He played it. I ran upstairs. I'm like, Dad, did you teach Michael how to play the boogie on bass? Because he's playing it like he was born in New Orleans 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And seriously, he's like a freak of nature with the bass.
I'm a quick learner.
I mean, did you pick up when it came to the bass guitar? And I mean, that's,
no, they tricked me into being the bass player.
How did they do it?
He should have been our
well,
lead guitarist.
So what really? it is they said, you know, you should really play the bass because all the girls like the bass player. But really, what it is they wanted to play the guitar, so they needed a bass player. Therefore, the youngest brother gets the bass and no girls. But whatever, you know, that's what happens when you're the baby of the family.
Well, I mean, talk about the music. What are the influences for the Safes? Because there is
everything.
I mean, you guys have a styled sound. I mean, the sound of the sort of very I don't know the right way to say it, but the twangy guitar with the sort of the driving drums. Right. I mean, it has a lot of punk influences, but at the same time, it's slowed down to almost almost I want to say like a British kind of music.
Definitely. Well, I mean, I think we all really liked. Like the early REM records, so that's like the twangy side, and mm-hmm. we really got
and
into
country music,
yeah. You know, because we grew up listening to country music and rockabilly and, you know, the Beatles, and then, you know, our cousin Billy Hennigan gave us the Ramones albums and the Cramps albums,
the Clash,
and so we had that when we were very young, in, you know, along with the Rolling Stones and the Who and all the normal good influences a band would have. We got a lot of weird punk rock albums. And classic, you know, we'd listen to traditional Irish music and country music and rhythm and blues. And so you kind of get, right. I mean, there's punk rock going on, but there's more going on.
Right. I think that you automatically, as being siblings, we're talking to the Safes, the Chicago rock band, the Safes, who are in Studio 435 tonight. You know, half the battle is getting guys together for rehearsal. I mean, that is half the battle of any band. The fact that you guys are siblings and growing up together, I mean, that has to have shortcut in the way that you could experiment, you could try new things. Were you guys practicing in the garage? How did it work?
Basement. In the Midwest, bands practice in the basement because it's cold. Imagine being in the garage tonight.
Right.
But yeah, we, you know, Patrick and Michael had a band of their own, and me and our older brother Sean had a band, so we didn't play. The four of us didn't play together until we started the Safes, and so they developed their kind of chemistry, and then me and Sean had our thing going. And then when we joined forces, we had kind of like this, you know, I don't know what the word is, but it was like, you know,
to know what the other person's gonna do before they do it is basically the gist of it. Is me and Patrick have a great connection because we've been doing it since I was 11 or 12, and Frankie and Sean have a great connection. But then when the four came together, it was just, you know, Frankie taught me things, Sean taught us things, so it was easy to oh yeah, I know what he wants here. Like, I can play bass with either of these two on drums, but my best relationship with the drummer is my brother Sean.
Right.
I know what he's going to do. He knows what we don't even have to look at each other, so it's nice. And now I have that with these two who switch off on playing drums. So
yeah,
it's pretty cool.
I mean, are you the kind? You can do that as musicians.
Patrick's about to play drums, and I'm going to sing and play guitar.
I can play drums on one song. We did it one time, and I can play "Don't Be Cruel" on the drums, just the beat.
All right, we may ask you to do that.
Hey, that's $5.
The Safes are in Studio 435 tonight. They have a new record out called "Record Heat," which can be found on iTunes, Spotify, other places. They're going to be at Township on Saturday here in Chicago, all ages show with The Difference, The Hustle, and the XOKs. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get another song from you guys.
Great. Cool.
Sounds good. It's The Download here on 720. Stay with us. All right, it is Studio 435 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, the Chicago rock band The Safes, Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley, all in studio. The brothers rocking out here on Michigan Avenue. The new record's Record Heat, which can be found on iTunes and other streaming sites. They're going to be on stage at Township this Saturday night. Saturday day, really. It's all day, right, kind of thing? All ages show with The Difference, The Hustle, and XOKs. And they are ready for track number 2. It's called Fairy Tale Tomorrow. Take it away, guys.
You know you're playing hard to get. Trying hard to forget. You scare yourself inside, you're dying. You're lying to yourself, you dream about me. You're playing games to keep the score. Giving less, expecting more. Don't fool yourself inside, you're dying. You're lying to yourself, you dream about me. Can't help but dream about me. Pride, pride, you away. You're gonna sink in a cubic sorrow. There'll be no fairy tale tomorrow. You're gonna sink in a cubic sorrow. There'll be no fairy tale tomorrow.
The Safes live at Studio 435 with the track Fairy Tale Tomorrow. They are, of course, the O'Malley brothers, Patrick, Frankie, and Michael. They are in studio. They're playing at Township on Saturday. When I say all ages day show, what time does that start?
First band goes on at 3:30. Mm-hmm. Safes play at 4:30. The Hustle play at 5:30. And The Difference play at 6:30.
There you go.
And I want to point out one thing.
Yeah.
The Hustle is our nephew Alex's band. Our brother Sean's son is a drummer, and I'm not kidding. And they're amazing. They're a great band.
Let me ask you this, guys. I mean, as we talk about music and you guys growing up and the positives of being a family unit, talk about, I mean, what kept you guys together? Because you say you're playing different things. Why not branch out and play with different people? And,
well, we have.
And tell the O'Malley family, take a hike.
We're better together.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
Well, we are. I mean... We've
played in other bands before, and it just seems to work out better when we play together. And like I was saying earlier, we come from the same place. We have the same drive, and we don't really need to talk too much. Like Michael was saying, there's a lot of telepathy, and you know, The other thing is, with a lot of bands, you can get into a fight, and sometimes if you get into a fight,
that's it.
The band will break up. But with us, there is Christmas. You know, there's Easter. There's, you know, birthday parties.
I love it.
So, you know.
And also over the years, like, we started out with our brother Sean, and he had to, you know, stop because he couldn't go on the road. And then Michael had to stop going on the road at some point because we he started a family. So we have – we do play with other musicians. Mm-hmm. We have had as many drummers as Spinal Tap. Now we're almost to that number of
that's where
touring
you guys all
bass
learned
players.
To play itself,
good,
right?
And they're good musicians and good friends of ours. So it's, you know, it's not always all three brothers, but it you know – or four, like sometimes when we played the night before Thanksgiving, Sean came up and closed the show with us. So it was, you know, like the original lineup from the first album closed the show.
That's great.
Yeah.
You know, I think about my brother's a musician, and I always think about it would take probably about 25 minutes for us to drop the guitars and start swinging at each other. Yeah. So what keeps you guys from, I mean, it's one thing, like you just said, about the idea that, yeah, you know, if there's a fight, there's holidays, you don't really, can't break up. Mm. But there also has to be some, you know, there's more tension because there's more there because you guys are brothers. I mean, well, what keeps you guys from not, you know, just sort of taking each other's heads
well,
off?
Well, that's funny because, you know, on The Hustle, the bass player from The Hustle is Ted Ansani from Material Issues' son. And Ted was at a show of ours one day where I, you know, looked at Patrick the wrong way, and Patrick took a swing at me on stage. And from that day on, Ted refers to Patrick as Lefty. So, I mean, that has happened.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it has famously happened. I mean, you know, Patrick's known every time we see Ted.
I did
he's
not
like, What's
think
up,
that
Lefty?
Was going to be the answer.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, I would think, I mean, I'm only thinking from my own experience that, you know, being creative with your siblings, yeah. I mean, there is a shorthand that you don't, I mean, there is something when you're creating with strangers or at least friends, there's a formality to it. But what, as siblings, there's that formality is taken away where you're like,
absolutely.
You know?
It gets uglier than, it gets ugly as you think it does.
Yeah.
Right? But then in the end, you get beautiful songs and you get great shows and you get like cool, cool memories. Like, That's the best part of it. Like, I hate them certain days and certain nights and certain minutes. Sure. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But then when we leave, it was like we just played on Michigan Avenue in the Tribune Building on WGN Radio. There's a life experience. Yeah. There's something cool that the three of us have for the rest of our lives together.
We're able to resolve issues really fast just from being brothers and loving each other.
And we are
Get down to it. Yeah.
And we are forgiving and forgetting.
We are super intense.
We wouldn't be here. This is 13 years in. We wouldn't be here if we couldn't forgive and forget some of the left hooks.
I mean, it's, yeah. there's a lot I want to ask about. I mean, there's a lot about the music, and I keep coming back to the idea of performing as a family. You know, as you talk about your other brother, Sean, or you talk about growing up in the household, what is it? I mean, when you think about, I mean, is it a sense of pride that the entire O'Malley family, as you know it, I mean, your unit is musical? I mean,
yeah, there's pride involved. And, like, let me tell you how deep it goes. We have seven sisters, okay? Six of them have kids. All of them play music, including this guy here. we made an album with Sean. Sean's on it. Michael's on it. All of our six sisters' kids play cello, violin, clarinet. You know, if I'm leaving an instrument out, tell me. You know, Austin plays the vibraphones.
I am. Singing, vocals.
Singing, drums. Yeah. So we made an album where, like, on each song, it would be the safes and then one of our sisters, two or three kids. So there's an album with 25. My parents have, like, 15 grandkids. Michael's two daughters are too young, so they're the only ones.
They got left off, didn't they?
Well, I think Emma was two or three when this was being recorded.
Yeah,
now Frankie's teaching her how to play the violin and the drums and a bunch of other things.
Is that your job? I mean, is your job to teach the O'Malley clan all
the
different
the whole neighborhood, man. I teach people all the time. I mean,
what is it? What is it about that? I mean, where do you think that comes from?
I was blessed with the gift for music, and I love music, and music is like my salvation and my, it helps me get through life. It helps me manage. And, you know, I don't know. It's...
And then him teaching my daughter how to play the drums. There's one thing that I don't want in my life, and that is a set of drums in my basement. You know what my dad gave my daughter for her birthday on November 3rd? Uh-oh. A set of drums.
Well, of course he did.
But they're drum pads, so at least I have that. But I have Frankie to thank. But she recognizes boom, cha, boom, boom. She recognizes drum beats now that he's showing her, and it's just like, I can't teach her that because I don't. She's my daughter, and I don't have the patience for it. But he's the cool uncle who can show her something cool. And after she gives up on it and just wants to play crazy drum beats, then he's cool and lets her play crazy drum beats. You know what I mean? And hit the cymbals.
Yeah, right.
And then my 2.5-year-old Olivia's just standing there with the microphone, and she has so much fun.
But there's
so
it's just amazing to me, and not a conversation that I've ever duplicated on Studio 435 about the nature versus nurture kind of conversation. But I mean, all the kids in your family are musical because is it a genes thing? Is it genetic, or is it the fact that you guys live and breathe it? I mean, the idea that you are introducing music to your children at such a young age.
I think it's both.
Both.
I
think it's definitely a combination.
It's nature and nurture. It's both for sure.
The Safes in studio, Frankie, Patrick, and Michael O'Malley, the brothers. We don't have enough room, I guess, for the rest of the siblings.
Yeah. It turned out to be like 19, like directly blood related brothers.
Can
and
we do?
On
can,
that
can we take? Can we do dibs? Can Studio 435 do dibs on the O'Malley, the full 19? Yeah. When you get to the point where you record the next album, where you bring the whole family in for Studio 435?
Okay. When we release that, we'll do it. All
right.
That sounds good.
All we right. did one. We did. There's
you're going to need a bigger boat.
We did a performance on WGN TV
with the whole family.
No, with about 6 or 7 of them. His sister played violin. Our nephew Ryan played violin.
Oh man.
Alex, who's drumming with the Hustle on Saturday, played drums. Me, Michael, Caitlin and Patrick played guitar. Oh, Caitlin played piano.
Gotta have you guys.
That,
yeah.
Like 8? Yeah, and that's on WGN TV. You can see, you can watch that.
Yeah, like, well, I want the full thing. Yeah, you can bring the select to the TV side. Right. The radio wants the full 19. Right?
When we release that album, we will bring it here.
All right, well, the album, The Safes just put out Record Heat. Also, they're going to be playing at Township on Saturday for an all-ages show with The Difference. All right, so we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news, and then we'll hear some more music from The Safes here in Studio 435. All right, thank you, Rob. Studio 435, our Monday Night Showcase featuring live music from the best Chicago has to offer. Tonight, of course, a family affair. The Chicago rock band The Safes, brothers Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley are in studio. They didn't bring the whole clan, the siblings and grandchildren, everyone that's
our
nephew Patrick is here. That's good. The Safes are going to be on stage at Township this Saturday for an all-ages show with The Difference. They're going to be on stage at 4:30. All right, they got some more live music here in Studio 435. Here is the track, Know It All. Take it away, guys.
1, 2, 3, 4. Who do you think you are talking down to them? You're so different. You claim to know so much, but I've yet to learn a thing. Though you can't show it, you think you know it all. Think you know it all. So you're better than me, does it make you feel good? Your strength's my weakness, yeah, your knowledge is secret. Say you can do anything when I put you to the test. Though you're gonna blow it, you think you know it all. Think you know it. To say, then I want to hear it. But if you were good in any way, you'd be willing to share it. Hey.
Live in studio, the Chicago rock band The Safes, Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley, the trio here of brothers. The O'Malley clan is much deeper than just these three, as we found out tonight. But they are playing at Township on Saturday, 2200 North California, Logan Square. They're going to do an all-ages show. They're going to be on stage at 4:30, sort of opening up for The Difference, who are sort of the headliners on this show. But The Safes, of course, Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley, the album Record Heat. You know, picking up on what we talked about, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, I think about, you know, I guess you go back to the idea of the Partridge Family, this concept of like...
Or the Jackson Five.
I mean,
or the Beach Boys.
Do you guys think about that? Do you think about the idea of the lineage of families playing together in
Not
the past?
Really.
No, it all starts with Hanson, the Hanson brothers.
Yeah.
You know, Mbop. That's where, when we saw them, we're like, that's what we should
do. That has to do it, right. You know, for you guys, I mean, when you think about the music, I mean, as we saw in that one, you guys were flipped around. You know, Frankie and Patrick, or Frankie and Michael, right?
Patrick.
You guys flipped, you know, you were drums, you were singing, Frankie. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of being versatile in that form. Was that the idea of the Safes when you started, or where's that come from?
No, I mean, that came out of necessity. That's because, like, you know, like I said, we've had as many drummers as Spinal Tap. So, like, a lot of drummers have played with us, and we've either parted ways with them or they've quit. And growing up in a house full of instruments, we had access to learn how to play the drums, the guitar, the piano, you know, the vibraphones, the accordion, whatever the case may be. And we've utilized that. So we actually, the reason we started, the Safe started playing as a three-piece was we had a two-week tour booked, a gig every night of the 2 weeks, and a drummer who had committed to it. And a month before the tour, he said, "Sorry, I can't go."
Man.
And then we, Patrick and I, both played drums in bands growing up in high school. We were the drummers in bands for the short period of time. So we played. And we said, you know what? We're not going to cancel this tour. We got a month. We're going to practice every night. I'll drum on your songs. You drum on mine. We'll do it as a three-piece. And we'll go out as a four-piece. We have friends that will come out and play drums and bass and to do tours. Or we'll tour as a three-piece. You know, we toured with Michael for 5 years before he started his family and stuff. And, I mean, it was out of necessity.
I'm happy it happened, though, because it's fun. I enjoy playing the drums. I mean, yeah. I'm typically a singer and songwriter, but
you're also,
I enjoy playing the drums a lot. It's a lot of fun.
You've been drumming as long as you've been playing guitar.
Yeah.
So have I. So it's kind of like...
Are they different brains, or is it the same? I mean, as from a musician's standpoint, I mean, playing the guitar or playing the drums...
It's all the same.
It's all the same?
To me, it is. I mean, to me, it's all the same. Yeah. I mean, I can't play anything that takes... If you can hit it, like if it's something you clobber like a caveman, I can make music out of it. If you need a technique like a saxophone with a certain breathing technique,
right,
or a bow, if you have to use a bow properly, like I can't play a violin.
Right.
But I can play anything that you hit like caveman.
And I enjoy it's like living in the moment playing the drums for me. I feel more comfortable playing the guitar. So when I'm behind the drum kit, I'm like, oh, my God, am I going to mess this up or what?
Plus,
so
the drums is the most important job.
You know, it's like, I don't know, sometimes feels like jumping out of an airplane and being like, man, I hope I land. So, you know.
None of you guys get into the bass? Is that just all your...
They can both play bass, but not as good as me.
Yeah, like, well, that's
there's
true.
One constant. When you're good at, like I am at the bass, you don't need to learn other things. You
and modest, too.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Michael is he should have been our lead guitarist
yeah.
the way he plays bass. I mean, that's
how so?
Real.
What do you mean by that? Like, just
well, I mean, he's
a better
monster.
Like, yeah, on that song I was just playing there, when we played as a three-piece, it's missing a second guitar. It's missing Patrick's rhythm guitar. So I play the rhythm guitar while Frankie's playing those things.
Right.
Most players don't do that. People look at me like I'm weird. Like,
yeah, you're
strumming playing
it.
Chords and I'm doing like melodic stuff. I'm playing guitar parts that the guitar player should
be playing. I mean, and I think about that the history of that kind of thing where bass is much more rhythmic in that form. I mean, do you see that a lot in rock music? You see that more in that last song we just heard, the Know It All. I mean, you get the feeling a little bit more of that punk kind of melodic punk kind of stuff.
Definitely.
Yeah. Is that because you'll hear that kind of, I mean, the bass kind of plays that way.
Yeah, I'm driving like, bass. Yeah,
we all
totally.
Have our own, like our favorite genre, and punk is like the Clash and Rancid and stuff, like the harder like stuff like that is what I listen to. Like I like to rock, you know what I mean? So like I try to give it a little bit extra. Like I used to break a string every show.
Yeah, and bassists don't do that.
There are bass players who don't.
Yeah, it is.
The first bass I ever had strings on it when my dad first bought it, and I broke the strings on it. He's like, those strings have been on there for 30 years. I said, well, it's time for new ones. And they're expensive, you know what I mean? So
they are.
But it's fun playing, you know, with them and doing the stuff. Like, people look at, like, are you playing guitar parts? And I'm like, yeah. I do whatever it is for the song to make the song better, and it's pretty cool.
Michael's a freak of nature musically. I mean, like, his capability as a musician is off the charts, beyond anybody I've ever played with. Like,
when it comes to writing music, when you guys decide to put a record together or work together on new music, as siblings, is the process collaborative? One of you bring it in? How do you guys write?
Well, it comes in all forms. Usually it'll come with one person shows up with an idea, like chord changes and words, and then the other person says, well, it doesn't have an intro or a bridge. So because all three of us write songs, and all three of us tell each other, I'll have a song where I'm like, I'm done with this one, and Patrick's like, you're not done yet. You know, like, that needs a middle eight or a guitar solo or a bridge or something, and then I'll fight with him for like 10 minutes and be like, no, I'm done with this song is done. I'm done. I've worked on it all day and I'm done. He goes, no, it's not done. You need it. It's repetitive unless you add something. And I'm like, all right. And I go back to the little demo studio and I knock out either a guitar solo or a bridge or something. Or like Michael will come with the song and I'll be like, all right, that's good, but let's make the chorus more melodic. Let's change the melody.
It's interesting because you have this chemistry and this connection as siblings that you can bring in songs that might be incomplete, ideas that might not go anywhere, but because the concept is you're comfortable with each other and you're not having to come in front of, you know, other musicians or artists and have to be afraid of being judged or anything like that.
That's true. And we also value each other's opinions. Mm-hmm. So though the initial reaction might be, no, I'm done. Like, in the end, it's like, you got to consider the outside thing. And generally what happens is the songs get improved. So.
Yeah, and we all have our own mixtape places that we make. We make our own demos. And I had this one part to a song that, it was just one part to a song. But I never could put a second part or a third part. And he took it for Cool Sounds.
Oh, yeah.
And this part could be in no other song but the song he took it and put it in. And it fits perfectly. He just took something from one of my demos and said, this is going to go here.
Yeah, I just grabbed it.
He just took it.
I'm like, that's mine. And it worked. And I was like, yeah, you just take things as they come, you know?
And like, I have songs that it's like, I had trouble writing words for the longest time. And so I wrote a bunch of instrumental songs and they're awesome, right? But then it's like, all right, I got to start writing words. And then I'll write the words, and then Frankie's like, those are good, but let's do this too. Instead of saying the same thing four times, let's change it up a little bit. And then the song then gets to be complete, and it's like catchy, hook, like really cool stuff. And so it is. It's just if one of us can get it to 80%, 90%, and then they come and put their stink on it, and then it's just like perfection.
Weird, as siblings, I mean, and Frankie, you're so committed to the music, I mean, to the point of even, you know, talking about earlier, teaching other people, and it's really your lifeblood. You know, I mean, how much of it is, as you mentioned with the drummers, they split on you guys, they take off, things of that nature. How important is it that you're committed to this band? The idea that, you know, if one of you guys are like, I like playing bass, but I'm not really sure. It doesn't work when you're brothers. You get so mad at each other. So, I mean, talk about the commitment to playing together.
Well, I think the proof is in the fact that we're sitting here 13 years later. We have an all ages show on Saturday. You know, I didn't think that I'd be doing all ages shows 13 years ago, but here we are. We're on WGN talking about our all ages show on Saturday. I mean, this is it. It's manifesting as we speak.
Yeah, and our parents taught us to work hard, and you do your best at it, and that's what we do. Like, we practice. We practice a lot. Sometimes it really sucks how much we practice, because when you practice,
Michael.
I'll be honest. You practice the same songs over and over and over, and it gets really boring. And you do stuff.
I like to practice.
They love it, and I hate it because. But I like doing different stuff at practice. Like, let's take that punk song and make it a bluesy jam. And it's like, we got a show Friday. You know what I mean? But that's what makes us what we are.
Is the work ethic.
You put huge. In the work, and you
get
the results.
And that came from our parents for sure. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
All right. Well,
it's love. I mean, it's true love. You know, it's.
Absolutely. The Safes, the Chicago rock band, Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley in studio. The album Record Heat, which can be found on iTunes, other places, other streaming sites. They're going to be on stage, all ages show at Township on Saturday, 2200 North California in Logan Square. They're going to be on stage around 4:30.
Correct.
All right, so we'll take a quick break, get the a chance to sound check the last song, and
we might have to figure out what song we're going to play.
We're going
to
figure out.
Know what we're
playing. Have a quick break to figure out what song we're playing next here. The Safes in Studio 435. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We are in the middle of, or at the end of Studio 435, our Monday Night Showcase, featuring live music from great Chicago bands like The Safes, Family Affair, three brothers, Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley. The album Record Heat can be found on iTunes and other streaming sites. The Safes are going to be on stage at Township in Logan Square, 2200 North California, on Saturday for an all-ages show. They're going to be on at 4:30 in the afternoon. With The Difference, The Hustle, The XOKs, and they are ready for their last track here in Studio 435 tonight. Here they are with the track Hometown.
I used to hate myself when I loved someone else. I'm back up on the shelf. There is nobody else. The sky is up and you look down. Measure up to me. The sky is up and you look down. Half empty cup for your hometown.
Thank you for having us.
There you go. The Chicago band, The Safes, playing at Township this Saturday, 2200 North California. That's an all-ages show. Doors open at 3 o'clock. They're going to be on stage at 4:30. Patrick, Frankie, and Michael O'Malley, the O'Malley brothers, and the Chicago rock band The Safes. The album Record Heat can be found on iTunes, other places. Guys, I can't thank you enough for coming in. It was great.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, that's going to do it tonight. Thanks to The Safes for performing live in studio. Bob Ferguson as well for engineering. We will be back on Wednesday. Tomorrow night, the Blackhawks and the Red Wings. We'll be back on Wednesday. Shep Gordon, a longtime manager. I just read his book, Supermensch. They Call Me Supermensch. What a I'm telling you, man. I love it. The memoir, that again, if you're not familiar with Shep Gordon, he was a manager to the stars. He essentially created the celebrity chef. He early clients included Emeril Lagasse and Charlie Trotter right here in town. But he his claim to fame was Alice Cooper. He was Alice Cooper's manager. And it's really interesting because if you remember Alice Cooper in the 70s or mid-70s, you know, he may not have had the number one. School's Out was a huge track, but what he was really known for was just the theatrics, the publicity, the stuff they would do. Alice Cooper, you know, the fame story of him biting off a chicken head, you know, and which is not what happened. But Shep Gordon was the orchestrator. He's the guy who orchestrated it all from, you know, backstage. And this is his memoir about being the guy that not only started with Alice Cooper and artists like that, musicians in the 70s, but celebrity chefs. And then Michael Douglas and Arnold Schwarzenegger and, you know, all the Mike Myers and all these people who became 80s, 90s and, you know, aughts superstars in film and TV. So he's had a whole life in Hollywood. It's the documentary I watched as well, which is good. So we'll be talking with Shep Gordon on Wednesday night. So that'll be fun.
Justin.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I do have an update for you on Derrick Rose.
What's the deal?
According to ESPN, Derrick Rose ache? Missing from the Knicks, said to have Chicago family issues.
Oh, man.
Chicago family issues, this according to ESPN. So there you go.
You know, it's you hear that. I mean, I hate to be, you know, someone who thinks of the worst, but, I mean, Derrick Rose and his family in Chicago is sort of, I don't want to say royalty, but they're well known, you know, the Roses and his family. So I hope everything's okay for him and his family, which is conflicting reports to what some reporters said out in the Knicks camp, which was he got in a fight with the coach and he left. So, you know, maybe that could coincide, those two things. He got in a fight and he has a family emergency. I don't know. And then again, you know what? I don't care about the Knicks. What did the Bulls do today, Rob?
They lost.
They got their butt kicked.
Yes, by Oklahoma City. It wasn't close.
It bucked the trend that was happening just recently with the idea that they play well against good teams. You know, they play good against good and bad against bad. But this is Oklahoma team is good and they got their butt kicked. But what can you do?
Yeah, 109-94 the final.
Yeah. All right, Patty Vasquez is live in Springfield tonight.